We are live.
Okay, great, thank you. We'll call to order the May 26th Hood River City Council meeting. And we have some presenters this evening. Our first order of business is business from the audience, once we call to order. And so Jonathan is going to allow our attendees one at a time to be unmuted, and we'll ask you to give your testimony and keep it to 3 minutes or less, please.
Are we ready, Ms. Mayor, for the first one?
Ready.
Okay. Mr. Jeremy Duncan, you have the ability to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for taking the time to let me address the council this evening. My name is Jeremy Duncan. I am the general manager for the Hood River Hotel on 102 Oak Street. As we all know, it's been a difficult time trying to navigate a constantly changing landscape where narratives and realities are changing on a day-to-day basis or even a minute-to-minute basis in some cases. Everybody's been doing the best they can, both at home and in the workplace, and that goes to that Hood River community has done a great job of weathering yet another storm that has been put in our path. So I just wanted to mention that everybody's been doing a great job in town of adhering to the social distancing practices and the ban on non-essential travel. But I am here to request a lift on that ban as people started coming out to the county on Friday the 15th. And then what we saw over the weekend of Memorial Weekend, they will continue to come from the valley as people are looking to get out of their homes and out and do some social distancing. And Hood River and the Gorge is one of those places. So along with the coast, Central Oregon, you know, we're seeing a lot of data in that direction that people are going to be coming out our way. A hotel is inherently a social distancing oasis on its own. You have quarantine guest room, a private bathroom, and cleanliness has always been something that we take very seriously for our guests. And then with the COVID pandemic, hotels across the country and in our region have enhanced those measures for sanitation and social distancing. And if you come to any of our hotels in Hood River, you can see a lot of those implementations in place. So I just wanted to speak to you guys and lean on us as hoteliers. Use our facilities to spread people out from downtown, the waterfront, or any areas where people are going to gather. Give them some public restrooms to use. Give them guest rooms to use to quarantine themselves and social distance. And let us as hoteliers use our resources where, you know, some of the other small businesses in town may not have, you know, the extra funds, the extra people, or the extra supplies to do those things. One other thing is that a lot of hotels, including mine, received PPP loan funds, and we have certain requirements to get those loans forgiven. And the sooner we can open and get people employed, we can, you know, have a little bit more confidence that those will become grants instead of loan forgiveness. Like I said, everything's changing on a day-to-day, minute-to-minute basis, and there's not a lot of confidence and trust that those things are going to be forgiven. So anything that we can do to get those off our books would be great. I understand the county voted today to open non-essential travel immediately, but for them it's Friday the 29th. So I urge this council to do the same. That's it for me. So thank you so much for letting me speak. And we're always available for any questions, comments, concerns, or any additional info that you guys might need. We'll be happy to share. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
Okay. Next up is Bob or Steve Nato. I see a Steve at the bottom. I'm going to take a chance and give you a opportunity to speak. Is this Steve Nato?
Steve, you have to unmute yourself. I'm not sure if you have yet. There you go.
Yeah, this is Steve Tesmer. It's not Steve Nato.
Oh, okay.
Wrong Steve.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Then I do not have a Nato present. And I do not recognize... here we are. We have Grant Polson on his telephone right here. I'm going to allow him to speak.
Hey, everybody. I'm in a vehicle. I don't know if my signal is good. I was just calling to express my support for lifting the executive order and allow lodging properties to reopen. We have appropriate PPP and all that sort of good stuff in order to keep our community, our employees, and our guests safe. We taking the additional steps of having additional face masks available complimentary to our guests so they can remain safe while they are around, that sort of thing. If there's anything else we can help or answer questions like that, we're around to help with that. Thanks.
Thank you, Grant.
Okay, our next member of the audience is going to be Michael Sprague. Feel free to unmute yourself, Michael.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you for being available to consider this. I'm also, providing testimony in favor of lifting the lodging ban. I own and operate the Inn at the Gorge Bed and Breakfast. And what I've seen happening in our community with traveling and people traveling here has concerned me a little bit in terms of it does seem that people are still coming to Hood River. And, in addition to wanting to see us protect our public health and revitalize our economy, also want to make sure that we're not taking action that's actually having maybe a potentially detrimental effect on public health. When people come and don't have access to restrooms, when they come and the only place that they feel kind of safe or welcome is in a restaurant, they kind of tend to linger, fill up those spaces. More and more, it seems like we're learning that there's not as much surface transmission on these viruses, that being in confined spaces with a lot of people is really what we need to try to protect against. And I do think that for people to have access to private spaces that are well and professionally cleaned is important, to have access to their own bathroom that is well cleaned. I think it's hopefully going to reduce the load on other businesses and reduce kind of bottlenecks. Providing, and I also want to communicate that I think that one of the things that lodging isn't really well equipped to try to keep people away. We are equipped and already experienced at really kind of providing or developing rapport with guests and trying to help them understand under normal circumstances how they can most enjoy their visit to Hood River. And so we already have a lot of skill in communicating and telling people that. And one of the things we could do now is tell people how they can best visit Hood River and communicate community concerns and needs and how to make this a safe visit for everyone. So if there are certain businesses that want to see less traffic or don't yet feel prepared for a lot of traffic, I think encouragement to stay away from those would be very effective. I think more than ever, one of the things people are wanting to get away from is a certain sort of social disapprobation. So if we tell people via personal communication, via that on the phone or email or carefully in person, that these are the places that Hood River would like to see you, and these are the places that Hood River would not, would prefer that you don't access as much or not at all, I think that might be pretty effective. Because I think that just avoiding sort of a certain kind of scorn is something that people are going to be very responsive to now. People in the cities, from Multnomah County, my understanding is they don't actually have a higher level of COVID now. They just haven't had, they don't have a contact tracing in place to be able to move out of phase one. So when we think of people visiting from other parts of the state, I think it's important to recognize that they don't necessarily have some higher level of virus. And people who've been able, and cities that have been able to keep viral spread low, I think are showing really amazing discipline in social distancing to be able to do that. As other sort of vacation or destination places around Oregon reopen, I think it's important for Hood River to be able to do our part in spreading the load of people who are choosing to travel. If we stay closed, we're increasing the burden on those other places. So if one of our interests, and I think it's all of our interests, is to protect public health, I think we need to see that as a we're all in this together, and not too narrowly define that to just Hood River, but see that at least as all of Oregon. I think many of us who operate lodging in Hood River feel a close connection to the community, friends, families. We're invested here. I'm sure there are hotels with external stakeholders, but we are invested in the community, and we feel like we'd like to help people use Hood River or visit Hood River in a way that helps Hood River, that supports Hood River, that supports the public health, and that supports, you know, their needs to get away, to have a little bit of relief during this very stressful time. I think the interests of lodging and the people of Hood River are actually very closely united in this. And we'd like to be able to do our part to help Hood River recover and continue to be a safe and wonderful place to live and work. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Michael.
Yep.
All right. I still do not recognize any of the attendees as a Bob or Steve Nato. So I am going to continue on. And Megan Ramey, I'm going to allow you to speak here. Megan, you are unmuted. We can't hear you.
Can you hear me, or?
We can hear you. It's not very loud.
Okay. I will try to get closer. Okay. Is that a little better?
That's better.
Okay. I'm just right next to my microphone. So I apologize for, thank you to Jennifer for adding me late to the game here, and I will be referencing the written testimony that I sent you guys in this comment, and I just thank you guys so much for all that you're doing right now in such a crazy time. I have four proposals for you to, as a pandemic response and recovery method, and these each of these proposals include a myriad of articles and quotes from around the globe, including Leavenworth, population 2,000 people, to Tel Aviv and Paris. So this is both a small town and a big city issue that we're dealing with. So my first proposal is for streeteries on Oak and Waterfront, which would be opening up the street to allow restaurants to expand their seating and get a jump start on their recovery. We're seeing this from all over the U.S., and especially with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission allowing restaurants to open up and serve alcohol into public space. It's a great opportunity, and you can see the quote from the mayor of Leavenworth on why they are doing this. The second proposal is to establish a Slow Streets network. And I might want to add that all of these I consider temporary measures for pandemic recovery and response. So the Slow Streets network is a soft, like a opening of neighborhood streets for residents to socially distance in a responsible way. I'm going to include, and there is a map that I included of prioritized streets that I would recommend, the first being June A and Wilson, and the second is Columbia to get people from Safeway to downtown. Here's a quote from a mom that I liked from this article in Curbed is, "We've run into, albeit with ample social distance, countless neighbors and school friends that we hadn't seen in 5 weeks while taking our daily rides up and down our street. The parents talk through makeshift masks about which wave we're riding that day. Grief, anger, delight, hope. It's saving our mental health, but also strengthening our civic bonds." The third proposal I have is installing a pop-up bike lane in the Heights from June Street to Rosars, and I included a cross section that is in our transportation system plan, and that would involve repurposing only one of the 8 vehicle lanes on 12th Street to create a two-way protected bike lane that would give both people walking and people biking more room. So just a story from last night, our family biked to the New Solstice Pizza Truck, and in the 20 minutes that we spent enjoying our soft serve in the parking lot, there were 6 different families and couples who arrived by bike, 4 of which got there by biking the wrong way down 12th on the sidewalk. In that same time, 2 groups arrived by cars. Almost everywhere in town, but especially on 12th, parents and teenagers are riding e-bikes on sidewalks because they feel safer there, which is creating friction and a safety hazard with people walking. We are one misunderstood maneuver away from a child or adult being pushed off the sidewalk into the path of a vehicle going 35 plus miles an hour. Equally as destructive would be an out of control e-bike hitting and injuring an unsuspecting person walking on the sidewalk or a person getting out of their vehicle. There is no possible way to socially distance on the sidewalk from Pacific to Union without stepping out into the vehicle travel lane. My fourth proposal is, first of all, I fully support what Jonathan is presenting later on a Safe Routes to School June A. Wilson plan, and would ask the city to support and sign a letter of commitment for a Safe Routes to School grant that is called the Project Identification Grant. And that is due, the letter of intent is due June 15th, and the application is not due until August. And this is just the first step of ODOT's kind of feeder program into Safe Routes to School. And I can help with all this by drafting that grant application, by recruiting volunteer builders and neighborhood ambassadors for the slow streets or pop-up bike lane construction. And then I will be testifying at ODOT's next ACT meeting, asking them for local government carte blanche to repurpose our highways for congestion mitigation and social distancing. And sorry if I went a little over on time, but thank you so much.
Okay, finally, I did see Mr. Nato raise his hand earlier and then lost the connection. Are you still here, Mr. Nato? Please raise your hand again. I guess we have lost him. That should be all, ma'am.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for everyone that testified in business from the audience. So we'll go right into work session. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No, we do not, Mayor.
Okay. So our first discussion item is the COVID-19 response. So did you want to start that off, Rachel?
Sure, Mayor, I'm happy to. I thought I might just give an overview where we're at with reopening and also where some of the recreational entities are at with reopening, to the best of my knowledge. I do also want to say that Lynn Burdett is on the phone, so if we have questions, we can direct them to her. As you know, on May 15th, Hood River County entered phase one reopening for the state of Oregon. That basically means that we met certain public health criteria to allow some businesses to open. And the earliest we would enter phase two is June 5th, based again on that public health data and healthcare capacity. Recreational areas are beginning to reopen. The port may reopen the event site later this week. It's my understanding that Mountain Hood National Forest may reopen on May 29th, and some Oregon parks are open to limited visitation, with more being open this week, including Hatfield Park and Trail here just out of Hood River. And then Oregon State Parks camping resumes June 8th. I don't have a specific date for some of the other areas in the waterfall corridor. So as you know, playgrounds and other high-use local recreation areas are closed per the Oregon Health Authority recreation guidelines. And we're still waiting for the health authority guidance for phase two, but are tentatively planning to reopen Waterfront Park, assuming the guidelines would allow for that when we enter phase two, so probably on June 8th. We're working through some of the restroom cleaning and may get some of the public restrooms open early. Right now, State Street restroom is open. And we haven't heard yet whether or not Oregon Health Authority guidelines will allow playgrounds to open at this time. So we'll just continue as we have throughout the pandemic to follow those Oregon Health guidelines. So to maintain readiness and flexibility to respond, the city's emergency declaration would be extended until at least June 8th. The state of Oregon is still in a state of emergency. That emergency has now been extended to early July. Unless directed otherwise by council, the emergency declaration would be updated to align with governor's orders, continue to align with governor's orders and Oregon Health Authority, and would not include the restriction on lodging. The new executive order would be effective May 29th, and this would be consistent with Hood River County. Now, a few more points that I think is worth mentioning, since we have so many people here on the call. I wanna clarify that non-essential travel is, phase one guidance includes a restriction on non-essential travel. And the guidance says that individuals should continue to minimize non-essential travel whenever possible. And travel away from home for recreational or vacation purposes is strongly discouraged and should be avoided through phase one of reopening. And the city of Hood River will continue to collaborate with all of our partner agencies on these and other public health messages, including the wearing of face masks in public. And with that, I'll turn it over to council for any direction or discussion.
Thank you, Rachel. Thanks for that update. Mark?
I just have a question. What is the known delta between phase one and phase two as of what we know right now? I mean, what are we looking at as far as gross wider doors, bigger opening when we get to that threshold?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Councillor. If I understand correctly, and I know you'll let me know if I haven't interpreted the question right, but we need to wait 21 days, and there are certain public health criteria and capacity numbers that need to continue to be met. My understanding about phase two guidance is that, well, we don't have it. We're expecting it this week. We have seen very little, but that we can expect little to change with regards to physical distance, wearing of face masks, and with regards to some of the businesses. I don't know with regards to summer camps or overnight camps or sports teams. We just haven't seen that guidance. So I really couldn't tell you what that will look like.
I thought there was some discussion earlier, but I don't know if it's been confirmed, that group gatherings, potentially a group gathering of 10 could become a group gathering of 25. So there was some discussion early on of group gatherings being a little bit larger, but social distancing in restaurants and all those kinds of things would be the same as phase one from what I heard in the initial discussions.
Yeah, and Mayor, I would concur with that, and I really hesitate to even speak to it, because even when the phase one guidelines were coming out, we would see drafts and then they would change. I just think this is such a dynamic situation that I really hate to speak to it without having seen that guidance from the governor's office. And I know any of the business owners that are on the call can appreciate, or any of you, how dynamic the situation has been.
Megan, did you have something?
I think Rachel answered it.
Oh, okay. Does anyone else want to chime in right now?
Yeah, I would kind of like loop back to somebody had made a comment that the county had approved non-essential travel. Do you know what that means?
Councillor, thank you very much for the question. The prohibition on non-essential travel is at the state level. I believe what the speaker was referring to was that the county is anticipated to lift their leisure travel, a leisure stay, recreational stay, lodging ban on the 29th. And I believe that just happened earlier today at their discussion and would be finalized on the 29th.
So how does that comport to you? I mean, I'm trying to resolve these things. At one hand, we're having people saying that we're not supposed to travel for non-essential activities, and then at the same time, you know, we're having these things where people are saying it's like, well, we're open for leisure and recreational travel. I mean, those things seem conflicted to me.
Mayor, would you like me to address that?
Sure.
Councillor, I'd be curious to know what the rest of council would think about that. I can't say that I necessarily disagree there. There is a tension, and the Oregon Health Authority has, and that tension has been there through the entire incident. The Oregon Health Authority has not restricted lodging.
Right. But, you know, just getting right to the point of potentially opening up lodging. I mean, if we do that, I mean, who are we opening up lodging to? I mean, if Multnomah County is supposed to be not traveling out to other counties, and I think I just read that on their website today, how do we reconcile that with somebody wanting to travel here from Utah or somebody else, somewhere else? I mean, I think that there's attention is probably a good word for it, but there's kind of like conflicting things going on that I'm trying to resolve for my own benefit.
Councillor, I think you're absolutely right. And I think there are probably as many opinions on this matter as there are people in this community. And so I'll leave it to council to decide on a different direction. You know, my job as your city manager is to tell you what the public health guidelines are as I understand them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, it is a hard thing to reconcile, Tim. The state has never had a ban on travel to or from other states or to or from other counties, and has never had a ban on lodging for anyone anywhere. So, you know, we put in special circumstances here as they did on the coast and they did in Central Oregon. Central Oregon is lifting those. The coast is lifting those now. Because, you know, we were some areas that got especially inundated. You know, that's kind of the reality of it. And so I think personally, I think right now with the other places opening and people are traveling, there is no law against people traveling, even though there's a recommendation not to travel. People are traveling to some extent. And so I think that we have had this phase one now for a few days, which has given some businesses that weren't open at all some time to kind of get used to the idea, kind of move their tables apart, have a few people back into work. So I think that's what they're talking about with a slow opening is let's try this, let's do a little bit of this and see how it works. So now we've kind of started with that. And also places on the coast. And now we're gonna start opening things more back to what the rest of the state already is. So that's the ask, that's what we're talking about. And it doesn't make 100% sense to anyone on either side of the issue, I don't think. Others? Jessica?
Thank you, Mayor. I definitely understand that the community is afraid of the visitors coming here. And I am too, but I do not feel that we can impose a ban on lodging any longer. I recognize why we did it in the first place. And I just feel that, especially with everybody else opening up and the lack of guidance from our public health entity at the county level and from the state, I don't think that we can impose the ban any longer. I think that we can lean on the governor's message to restrict non-essential travel. And I also appreciate some of the offers that we heard today, where I think we can lean on our lodging partners to really help direct the people that come to how best to engage with our community. Let them know what is open, what's not open, you know, giving them masks, encouraging them to use them. I think that's the best that we can do right now.
Megan?
Yeah, I've been struggling with this one a lot because I mean, fundamentally, I'm just frustrated that if we were actually functionally getting support from higher jurisdictions, we should never be making this decision at all. I mean, clearly the best thing for public health is people aren't traveling, but we've never been given the resources. Our local businesses, our local community members have never been given the resources to actually make the right decision for public health. So we're now faced with basically and I have sympathy for it, of the lodgers are staring down the barrel of giant grants that are likely to become loans if we don't open up. And I, you know, we can't ask them to go bankrupt. But it's still not a good idea if we're actually talking about this community's health and well-being. And I don't think there is a right way to balance that, honestly. So I'm finding it super problematic. I do, clearly we've been having people visit already, obviously less than a normal Memorial Day. And I just, the idea of anything like a normal summer in Hood River where we double the population of the city on a weekend and it's new faces every weekend. And it's just, we don't have the healthcare capacity for that. We don't have the space to socially distance with that. We don't have a way to safely host that kind of population. And I don't know how we maintain the restrictions. I don't think we can, but I also, it seems like the worst idea in the world to lift the restrictions, because that is basically a full-on invitation to come here to treat this like a normal summer. You know, I found it especially concerning one of the business from the audience speakers of people want to come here and get a bit of relief. And Hood River can't be seen as a safe place that doesn't have the disease, where you don't have to worry about distancing like you do in your hometown. People need to understand, if they're coming here, that they need to take it seriously. They have a significant responsibility to this local community to protect our health and the health of everyone they're interacting with. And I don't know how to enforce that. I don't think we haven't, again, we haven't been given resources to have that mechanism. But I need the lodgers and everyone else working in industries that are attracting people here to realize that that's incredibly dangerous and it's incredibly stressful for the local community. And I still don't really know what I want to do. So I'm gonna let someone else talk.
Eric?
Sure, Mayor. Thank you. I share a lot of the sentiments that have been spoken here, and I appreciate the weightiness of the decision that is on council's desk. I think, speaking first to Tim's point about the tension, there is a tension there. I agree. It seems to me the decision before council is, do we want to direct our city manager to essentially continue to, we were criminalized staying in a hotel except under very limited circumstances. And I think I share the sentiment that this is a careful step, but nonetheless an appropriate step, that we should go ahead and do that. And I also think, you know, just mechanically, we should, at the end of this discussion, I think as a council, speak to it very specifically, so there's no ambiguity in the community. You know, having the city manager just renew an order is less desirable to me than actually having us vote and direct. But that's just a process issue. I guess, you know, fundamentally, I think we have to put our faith in the people to do the right thing. You know, phase one has our businesses slowly reopening with social distancing measures in place. It is scary. I've felt that fear myself. But we are putting our faith in our business owners and other market sectors to do the right thing. And I'm not feeling appropriate to just single out this one market segment as somehow incapable of doing that. I think we've heard from our hotelers. We've seen them, at least in writing, signed by numerous hotel companies saying that they would abide by the ORLA, the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association's guidelines for cleanliness and some other things. Frankly, I think it would be fine for us to suggest that if they do reopen, that they follow those so that we are providing some guidance. But the numbers are such, in terms of, you know, the COVID reality, we're 2 months into this. This has been a big ask on this one market segment. And in addition to the PPP funds and that issue, I imagine there's just regular debt service that hotelers have on their properties. And if I'm hearing these folks right, they haven't mentioned that specifically, but I can only imagine that that is becoming a pressure point. And, you know, as we battle this disease from a public health standpoint, we have to keep in mind to right-size our reactions so that our response doesn't, you know, create a situation that introduces other potentially, you know, very bad situations that ruin lives in other ways besides health. And given that we have, at least to my understanding, you know, 13 or 14 positive cases in the county, 12 fully recovered. We had one hospitalization that's been fully recovered. I'm just not seeing the empirical case to continue the ban at present. Does that mean we don't continue to keep a very close eye on it? Absolutely not. I think, and we have the wonderful staff that we have that's monitoring this, and it could be that we put this right back in place if something negative happens. But looking at the curve, it just seems a difficult but reasonable step to sort of take off this ban that is really an imposition, an enormous financial imposition on one market segment in our community. The other thing I would say is let's stay consistent with the county. It was mentioned here, but it is my understanding that at a meeting this afternoon, at least in a work session, the county seemed to reach consensus, its commissioners, that on Friday that they would lift this ban. So they're going to do that. And so it seems like we should be consistent on having the city doing something separate from the county. But I do think it's important for the hoteling community to stand by what they said they would do, which is follow those ORLA checklist guidelines that spoke about cleanliness, social distancing, and all the other things we heard about. And, you know, this is a weighty decision and not one I take lightly, but, you know, I am prepared to encourage our city manager to move forward without the ban at the present time.
Thank you, Eric. Gladys, you had your hand up? Go ahead, Gladys, and then Mark.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
As a frontline healthcare worker, I'm really concerned. I echo the frustration or the tension that others are feeling. I wish that we were in a position where we were saying, let's pay people to stay home and that we have the money to do so, as opposed to let's run the risk and see what happens. We're not in a position where we can see what happens here in the Gorge. And I'm just really concerned of lifting the ban on hotels and what that does. The Gorge, as many of you know, is expecting a minimum of 6,500 essential workers that will start soon. And there's a plan in place for them, but there's no plan in place for hundreds, if not more, of tourists that are coming in. I'm going to make a decision based on the safety, based on what I see, my experience being in the healthcare world. And I just have a lot of concerns that we'll have an outbreak and that this will cost folks their lives. And we've been fortunate that we haven't seen it yet here locally. But just concerned of what will happen. Hoping that maybe we can allow the coast to open and maybe kind of use them as the test subject to see how it goes over there. What are their issues that they're having? But I feel like I have to make a decision based on safety, based on science. So I'm just echoing my concerns and frustration that we're in this position and that we're not in a position where we're offering folks resources to stay, offering businesses resources to stay closed to keep their people safe.
Mark?
Yeah, those are good things to keep in mind, absolutely. I've been thinking that in this imperfect situation, our biggest strength is sticking together with like communities, that we are following whatever is, you know, OHA is a science-based advice, and we're following that. It's not the perfect science-based advice. I don't think that exists. But we're following OHA. We're following the governor's plan. I think that we should be in lockstep with our fellow tourism-driven communities in the coast and in central Oregon. I think that we should definitely be in lockstep with the county to not go wahoo, but to continue to gently open, to continue to watch carefully, to continue to encourage the health community to be able to do testing and the state to be able to do tracing. That's a better path than trying to keep the walls up, which is not a possibility. So I don't believe that keeping up the walls is going to be possible. So I think that the better path is to work with partners, open stuff up carefully, watch carefully, and react to what we find. So that's right.
Others, anything else? Gladys?
Yeah, that's the problem, Mark, is that we don't have the room to isolate folks. there's a couple steps that we're missing, right? And because we don't have that put in place, I feel really uncomfortable making a decision saying, yes, let's just test it and see how it goes. And then someone loses their life because of it, or, you know, worst case, just someone gets sick or multiple people get sick. I like that folks are business owners are coming on and they're saying, we're going to follow these guidelines and we're going to make sure that our guests follow these policies and procedures that we have put in place. But we all saw this last weekend. I'm sure that you all got the same emails I did of community members that are reaching out to you and saying, where is the enforcement? We can't put that on the health department to go and enforce that. We can't also put that on our officers and then have it turn into, well, I got told this because of, you know, this and that. So just that comment.
Tim?
I just wanted to follow up on a couple of numbers. I mean, I think we should be, you know, very open that if we, when we lift this ban, that really what we're doing is we're opening up our town for tourism, right? Like full on tourism. And just to put it in perspective, I think Megan mentioned that our population doubles and Gladys threw out some other number, but really, you know, on a good day, our population increases by 3 times. That's 25,000 people that could potentially be in our community, 17,000 of which don't live here. So that's really what we're talking about. And I think that we should really be transparent about that, because we're going to have 17,000 people potentially showing up here and interacting with everything that we interact with. You know, to me, I heard Mark say that we should be in lockstep with this and that. You know, I agree with that, you know, and maybe one of the things we should be in lockstep with is kind of like the phased opening part of this, where, you know, we're not even totally through phase one, right? And phase one is supposed to be kind of like a trial experiment. How are we doing? Are we seeing increases or decreases? So on and so forth. So in my mind, at the very least, we should try to time it with the ending of the phases and having it be kind of like structured that way. Because otherwise, you know, just, you know, making a decision on something else just makes it even less, in my mind, rational. Other than, you know, it's you know, it's a very economically costly for not only for our hotels and Airbnb and transient lodging owners, but also the restaurants and everybody else that depends on tourism here. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, if somebody were to lose a family member and you were to ask them, you know, in retrospect, would you have preferred we could keep this ban in place, or would you think it was worth it? That I think that they would prefer to have their family member alive. So, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at. So at the very least, I think we should think about trying to time it with the phasing things. We're not really we're like only partway through phase one. You know, from what I'm seeing, we're seeing businesses and restaurants just starting to get, you know, thinking about how do we actually do this socially distancing thing. So they're not really all together there. And to like dump 17,000 people on them, you know, is going to be stressful for them and their employees. And honestly, I think it's going to be dangerous for their employees until they start to work through some of these issues. So, I mean, those are kind of my, you know, I just want to just state it clearly that that's what we're talking about here, is we're just kind of like, once we do this thing, we're just kind of like opening it up. Because I don't see how we can say, Portland people, you stay away, you know, don't come here. Play close to home, but, you know, you folks from Utah and Colorado or wherever else you're coming from, sure, come on in. You know, that doesn't make any sense to me. So anyways, those are some of my thoughts.
Megan and then Gladys.
Well, and I guess I'm not sure why, and on Tim's end, why we would be welcoming Utah and Arizona, but not Portland. To me, it doesn't particularly matter where they're from. It's the quantity and the reality of it's, you know, kind of like you shouldn't be mixing households right now, like to mix different communities is clearly risking spreading contagion. Because larger issue, and again, my frustration with higher jurisdictions, of we still don't actually know who has this disease or not. There are still people out there who don't realize they have it and may be spreading it. And we don't have the resources to solve that for the nation, obviously. But I do, I mean, you know, we're really talking about within roughly a week, week and a half time frame of when we open. I can see pros and cons of all ends of that spectrum, but it's really the, how do we, whenever we do this, we lift the restriction. Is there some way to allow people to stay in the hotels but not get this wave of thousands or tens of thousands of people descending on this community? Is there a way to force, you know, hotels and short-term rentals and tourist businesses and Visit Hood River and the Chamber and everyone whose normal job is to draw people here, is there a way to get them to really own up to the responsibility they have to the local community they are part of, to not be advertising, to not show that this place is the place you should come and escape quarantine? What can we do within this scope? Because we need to do something.
I think part of it, just your next, Gladys, just a minute. I think part of it is that even if we don't let anyone else in, that we have a couple things. We have businesses that are could collapse, which isn't good. We have people in our community that are asymptomatic right now with no one else coming here. Or 99% of the people that come and visit might not have COVID. I mean, we have no idea. We really have no idea. We know that if you have people that live very close together, especially living in situations such as group homes, that it can spread because you're together all the time. And it's worse in those areas. I've been reading some things that say, you know, if you're outside, you have much less chance of contracting COVID if you're outside and you're 6 feet away from each other. So, you know, inherently, people that come to visit here, a lot of people want to be outside. It puts them in it might put them in a restaurant. It might put them getting takeout food and standing in a line 6 feet away from each other. But I don't know if, I really don't believe we're going to get 17,000 people. You know, I looked at what was happening this last weekend. It's not business as normal. I mean, there's people coming up day tripping for sure, even when we said don't come. But nothing like we would normally have, not even close. And I don't believe we're going to get anything close to what we would normally have this summer, even if we're open. I mean, there's just a lot of people that aren't going to travel. I don't think we're just going to be an oasis. Some people, yes, will want to come, but I don't think we're going to be as busy as we've normally been because people are afraid to travel. Gladys, go ahead.
To be honest, I lost my train of thought.
Oh, sorry. Mark?
Yeah, just I think, you know, this is a great discussion, and this is just so important. I think it's important to recognize that we are in phase one with tighter than everyone else restrictions as of the first, right? So we're not, and the my opinion that we open, you know, in the next week, the hotel part still means that we're still in phase one. We're still watching. We're still not moving, you know, opening other businesses and stuff. So I'm not advocating at all, you know, a willy-nilly return to whatever we want to be normal. I think that phase one is already diminishes capacity, and if we can work together as a team, that's the hoteliers, the city, council, the county, if we can be on the same message, it sort of addresses Megan's thing of avoiding the come on down, the gorge is open, let's have a party. The message should be, you know, this is, we're a little community, we feel like we're at risk, you're welcome to come, but please participate in safe behavior. Enjoy the old highway, but don't have 50 of your friends cracking a 12 pack in the parking lot, good behavior. And I think that by staying on the plan and opening the hotels gently, we're going to have more people that are willing to stick on message than if we, you know, poke one group at the expense of another group and stuff. So that my hope is that we can all be speaking the same language of careful watching, but slowly opening. So whether that's just being a Pollyanna, like some of you guys probably think, that is where I think our hope lies. So.
Okay, Gladys.
I remembered what I was going to say. I want to know if there is any, these businesses that are going to open, where are they receiving their training, or what agency are they receiving their training from? Is it specifically from OHA, the health department? Is there some sort of healthcare agency that is training these individuals, these businesses, to come up with, you know, plans for their guests, how to talk about washing your hands, what is the importance of social distancing, what are the signs and symptoms, and then where to go to connect in the community should you have signs and symptoms? Are they going to do like temp checks? Like, is there a list that they have, or as I mentioned, any sort of healthcare agency that's helping them, whether that's the health department? Because I can tell that I'm probably going to be a nay, and most everyone else will be yay, and that's okay. But what is the plan to ensure that these guests, whomever they are getting appropriate, accurate information from a specific healthcare agency?
Rachel, do you have any, we did get some information from Oregon Restaurant and Lodgers Association regarding their recommendations, and I don't know if they got their information specifically from the Oregon Health Association or not. Rachel, do you have any input on that?
Mayor, thank you for the question, counselors. My understanding is the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association has put together a checklist of how hotel operators can operate safely. Of course, all public health agencies are providing public information right now and public messaging. But again, I don't believe there are any specific Oregon Health Authority restrictions or guidelines regarding lodging. That's part of the challenge, I think, that you're all speaking about, that we're all talking about. Those are really lacking. At the local level, the county public health regulates lodging. I don't believe they've put out any specific guidelines. They are certainly encouraging everybody, public and employers, to follow those Oregon Health Authority guidelines. All employers have guidelines from the governor's office that they need to, that they're expected to follow. So, you know, Mayor, I don't know if that fully answers the question, but that's kind of the landscape right now. I would also mention that the messaging has been very collaborative with both Visit Hood River as well as some of the recreational partners, kind of taking this phased approach to welcoming people back to the gorge. And given that we're in phase one, we are not back to fully welcoming people to the gorge yet. So again, just a little context for you to help you make your decision. And I did also one more thing to Councillor Haney's point. There is a motion. There are motions suggested. There are a couple of choices within the packet. So when you get to that point, to Councillor Haney's point, there is a motion there that could be made.
Gladys?
And these businesses will have to have access to PPE, which is masks. So is there an agency that's going to help these hotels get masks, or do they have a supplier for masks and cleaning supplies? Cleaning supplies such as bleach, that has been an issue for as far as a shortage now. Is there going to be additional help from the governor, right? Because she's approved phase one of the reopening plan. Like, what other support are we going to get from the state if we do open our hotels to folks, so that we have the resources that businesses need to keep people safe while they are here? And that education piece, that's the most important, is that there has to be some sort of education that is going from the hotel owners to the guests that are staying here.
Megan, did you have something?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember it, but I do, you know, to Gladys's point, I would guess that the hotels have just as little support as all of the other businesses that either were open during the actual closure or are opening with phase one. I mean, this, again, there has been very little actual resource or other assistance to individual people, individual businesses, or to local communities to actually deal with this correctly. With regards to, you know, sector-specific guidelines for hotels and short-term rentals and whatnot to operate, my understanding is there aren't any. It's just the basic general business guidance from OHA. And even the Orla stuff is voluntary if you want a sticker that says we're doing good, roughly. And I, you know, within the, like, cleaning between visitors, hopefully social distancing between visitors, and their staff, I would expect the hotels to be just as good or not good as any other sector or any other individual business in the area. I think there is this comes back to there's a larger responsibility because they are bringing in folks, their business model is bringing folks in that is not just social distancing within your business and cleaning your business, but actually teaching your guests the responsibility they hold to this community. That is not covered in anything from Oregon Health Authority or really the Oregon Lodging, Oregon Business, I can't even say it, Restaurant and Lodging Association, that needs to be covered in some other way. And unfortunately, I think it has to be voluntary because we don't have any other mechanism, but it needs to be done.
Mark?
I would love it if, and maybe Rachel, you're already doing it, if staff could work with county staff and the lodging community and the whole business community to come up with a single page message that we're telling to visitors. I understand the Orla thing is, you know, good practices and staying safe within how they clean and stuff. And that's great. And I hope they're all doing it. But it's this. You know, what is the message we're giving to people that come? And there, I mean, it should be taped on every restaurant table and every given to every hotel guest. And it's just being, we want you to be part of the keeping the whole community safe is what we're, is the ask is. And the more that can be a single sheet of paper that everyone's using, the better. I don't know if that's too big an ask, but it would be pretty nice in my book.
I'm gonna jump in. That would be great and would at least help assuage some of my concern if we could get something like that together.
Didn't Rachel send us something that the community was working on together? Oh, like a one pager?
Yeah, thank you, Council, for the question. I'm happy to talk to Public Health Authority. You know, they are the ones that regulate lodging, so happy to talk to Public Health about this and through the Joint Information Center, see if there's something we could get out. I think what you're referring to, Councilor Mehta, we put together a sign for businesses that can go in their in their windows, and there's no reason why lodgers, anybody can have access to that. The city designed those, and we're paying for the printing costs for the posters, so the chamber is distributing those.
Okay, I think unless we have something specific, We might need a motion. Not sure if we have what we're how we're going to go here. But Eric, did you have something too, though? But I was thinking we could potentially go to a motion.
I did have some further comments, but I think I could just skip to the motion. I'll just read from the packet and go for the first suggested motion. I move to direct the city manager to exclude the lodging restriction from the extension of her emergency order. In other words, she's going to extend the emergency order, but exclude from that extension the lodging restriction.
Okay, we have a motion to exclude the lodging restriction from the continued emergency emergency order.
I second the motion.
Jessica has seconded the motion. Additional discussion? Tim?
Yeah, Mayor, I just want to say that I'm going to vote no on this motion. And it's not because I don't think that eventually we need to open, obviously we need to open the lodging back up. But I heard a lot about how much we don't know about this particular situation. And there is a lot that we don't know about the situation. And to me, and I hear what Mark was saying about that our restrictions are more than other communities. But the reality of the situation is that we're not like other communities. We are, we are very much driven by tourism here, and we have a lot of people come here. So to me, it doesn't make any sense to be only partway through the partial reopening, the phase one part of this, and then lift this restriction. It makes more sense to me to move it to the completion, the successful completion, I might add, of phase one, and then have it open up when we've moved into phase two. That would give us some reassurance that, businesses were doing the right thing, that we're not seeing increases in cases, so on and so forth. But to do it and say, well, we just don't know and people are going to come anyway, to me, that doesn't seem like a very rational decision. So I'm just stating that I'm going to vote no on the measure.
Thank you for your reasoning, Tim. Megan?
So, I'm struggling with, like, this Friday just seems really fast. I mean, that's, I guess, technically the 14 days, but barely, and into the phase one. And I would feel more comfortable if we stuck to, like, the June 1st date where we go one more weekend, assuming we complete phase one, we'd reopen on the 5th, which would be the next weekend anyway. But it gives us a little more space to say, was there any consequence to going to phase one? And kind of gives the community one more weekend to, like, hopefully get adjusted to the idea that we're basically throwing open the doors. This Friday, 3 days warning just feels like we're going to run into chaos. And there's not time for, assuming they're on board, there's not time to come up with the pamphlet of, hey guests, this is what we expect of you as, visitors to our community. There's no way we're going to come up with something good in 3 days. But if we could at least give a little bit more buffer and breathing room, I think I could say yes.
Okay, more discussion on the motion. We still have a motion.
I don't have a strong opinion that Friday is dramatically better than Monday. If that gave us time, like Megan said, to come up with, whether it's communicating that sign already exists or expanding on that sign so that it's a little more, and I apologize for not having a mind's eye picture of it in my head right now. I'm hip to the first. If that makes a practical difference to staff and in being prepared for it.
So I think we can have something in writing in one day. I really don't think that a few days is going to make that much difference. I think if they know today that they can open Friday, that That will give them a few days notice to get ready. I don't think Friday or Monday is going to make that much difference. And I really think that the lodgers, I'm sure from the ones I've talked to in the past, will definitely work with staff, and staff would work with them to come up with this one pager thing, and we can do it ASAP. So I don't think it's going to take long to get something together to ask them to hand out or put up in their establishments. Eric?
Madam Mayor, I guess I'm, first of all, just the diversity of thought on this call, I think, is really encouraging. Sort of speaking for different elements of the community, I'm just impressed with the tone and professionalism of the discussion tonight. So I wanted to say that. I wouldn't feel that strongly about June 1st, but the county has, to my understanding, created an inertia to go to Friday, and I think in the interest of staying consistent with the county, to not create confusion between different bodies of government, I would remain comfortable with this Friday. And finally, I would just emphasize, you know, the governor's orders are still going to be in effect. Social rule distancing rules are still going to be in effect for hotels, just like at restaurants. And if hotels cannot operate within the confines of at least the general recommendations from the OHA, they should not be, and they shouldn't open. They're going to still have to do that. And this is just such a difficult balance. I completely appreciate that. And it's hard for me to cast aspersions on anyone's perspective on this. We're all just, I think, doing the best we can to balance this. But it is a balancing. It's not just the one goal of preventing anyone from ever catching this disease. We have to keep in mind all the other issues that are before us as a city council. You know, I'm thinking, and I won't speak too long to this, but, you know, the TRT funds and having funds to accomplish our other goals like affordable housing, it's just, there are other goals we have to keep in mind, and it's a balancing for all of us, and it's a very difficult decision, but I'll be voting yes, and would be comfortable with the Friday date.
Okay, so Eric, you made the motion and Jessica seconded it, and we have it as it is stated here. The emergency order that is going to be kept in place would basically continue after today. So unless we state a date in the motion, it would actually take effect immediately. Is that correct, Rachel, or not?
Mayor, no. The next kind of expiration is the 28th. So
is the 28th. Okay.
Yeah.
So it would again, be 29th.
You're correct, Mayor. You can specify a date. You can direct staff to specify a date, and we'll figure out how to make that work.
Okay. Well, if the original order expires the 28th, then the 29th would be the next order going into effect. So that would, in effect, if the motion that Eric made and Jessica seconded, it would go into effect the 29th as it stands, which would be Friday. Okay. Mark, did you want one thing? I was going to call for the vote. Go ahead.
I just want to, Rachel, if we volunteer to help or promise not to try to help, do you think that producing some materials that could be given out by Friday is doable?
Yeah, Mayor, Councillor, thanks very much for the question. Appreciate it. I imagine that Visit Hood River will be happy to help with this, and the lodgers will be happy to help with this. So we'll put something together and we'll make it happen.
Would there be opportunity to review it and make sure it's actually, you know, going the direction Council wants?
If you have information that you'd like included, please send that to me as quickly as you can, and then again we'll work together to put something together. What I have heard is, and let me know how if I get this right, but be respectful in the community, wear a mask, abide by physical distance, follow hygiene protocols. Is that the type of thing that the council is looking for?
Yes, but what if they say they don't have masks, guys? Now we're about to open it up and we're going to go for it. Everyone open up lodging. Now what are we going to do to support these businesses by helping them with gathering the appropriate PPE? Not everyone travels with the mask, so are the businesses going to have masks to give out to individuals?
So I believe that the lodgers could ask people to bring a mask with them when they come to stay. But just like, you know, the people that live in our community already, some places are asked or require people to wear masks in their store, some don't. So I don't know that we can force them to wear a mask, but they could ask them to bring a mask with them when they come. I don't think that's unreasonable.
I don't think forcing is the word I was looking for, but yeah. As far as they don't have a mask here, we have masks to offer. We might, charge you $5 more for your stay because of the mask, but are we going to make PPE accessible? Are we going to create access for these businesses so that if they are encouraging their guests to wear masks out in public, that they can do so and that they have access to a mask?
I have, today I got resources about PPE that I'm happy to share with Visit Hood River. It's been going around to all the business community about, you know, here's a whole list of places where you can get PPE.
Great. Thanks, Jessica. Tim?
Just one more comment with respect to being in coordinating with and being kind of like consistent with the county. The only thing that I would add to that is that it would make it a lot easier for us to be consistent with the county if somehow there was some coordination about making these decisions. I don't recall being involved in any type of discussion about lifting any type of ban. I mean, obviously, I'm just saying that it would be easier in these situations to be consistent with what the county is deciding if there is some type of coordination between our two agencies. Other than that, really what I feel like is that they're just dictating to us what's going to happen. And, then we're supposed to follow along. And I personally don't feel comfortable with that.
I want to piggyback on that one. As counselors, we are not a part of the EOC calls or the joint information calls that take place. We are not a part of like a collaborative county city meeting so that we can, communicate and make these decisions together. Echoing that sentiment that I feel frustrated that we're not all a part of that.
So I am part of that, and Rachel is part of that, and so is Jeff Hexel, and so is Mike Oates. And Mike Oates and I have been talking about, basically just saying, are you going to discuss this at your next meeting? When is your next meeting? It will be on the agenda or it won't be on the agenda. He can't speak for his whole group and I can't speak for my whole group either. I said, I'm one vote, we'll be discussing it. And we'll be discussing it, whenever. But we've been in contact just to that extent, saying we will be discussing it type of things.
And I appreciate that, Mayor. But I think I hear what you're saying, but still in all, really what I'm trying to say here is that the argument that we should be consistent with what the county does kind of falls apart unless we're actually involved in those decisions and actually privy to them. I mean, saying that we're going to discuss them is one thing, but then having the county make a decision and saying, well, because the county made a decision, we should make the same decision, doesn't really ring true to me. That's really what I'm trying to say.
And I think some of the discussions that have been going on in the last few weeks have had to do with Forest Service and state parks and different recreation things that might open in the gorge. And so I've been on those calls. Rachel, Mark was on one call that I couldn't attend, and the county's been on those calls too, to try and coordinate things so that people open up at the same time, because we just felt it wouldn't be as much of a burden on one group or another if we all tried to do the same thing at the same time in general. So that was just the consensus of a larger group of probably 50 people that were on phone calls regarding the gorge in general, to try and be as coordinated as we could so individual places didn't get overwhelmed. That was the consensus of the whole group on those discussions. So I'm sorry, I haven't just given you all the information that I've had from some of those discussions, but that's kind of what the consensus was.
So I mean, I appreciate that sentiment, but given the large spread of dates that we've got in our packet or that Rachel has discussed, it doesn't seem like everything's opening on one date anyway. And I don't see, you know, yes, it's only a few days, but I don't see why we need to tie to the county specifically if, at least in my opinion of the larger community, 3 days warning is just not enough for folks to get a handle on what is going to feel scary for most people. That, you know, it's just like that one extra weekend would just give people that breathing room to get, understand what's going to be happening and what it means for them.
I had seconded the motion, and I heard Eric say that if we wanted to go to June 1st, I would second a June 1st, just to make things more complicated for the mayor to unravel.
Okay, well, right now we have a motion, so we need to, we've had a lot of discussion on it, so I think that I should call the motion. I think everyone has kind of given their sentiments about it, so I don't feel like I'm cutting anyone off, unless somebody raise their hand if they feel like I'm cutting them off, but I think everyone's kind of given their sentiments about it. So we have a motion as it stands to open the 29th for lodging, continue the emergency resolution to the middle of June. So I have a first and a second. So I'm going to do a roll call vote on that motion, and then if that doesn't go, we'll do something different. Eric?
Aye.
Megan?
No, I think you've heard why. I'm just not comfortable with that date, but I am generally supportive, or at least understanding of the fact that we do need to lift this soon.
Tim?
No.
Okay. Jessica?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
Gladys?
No.
And I'm going to vote aye. So we passed that motion. And it's extremely difficult. I knew this discussion was going to be long. I'm sure the people that are listening to this phone call can see that we've spent almost an hour and a half on this subject, because it's extremely difficult situation that we're in. There is a lot of different opinions, and they're all correct, and they're all very hard to make. And I really appreciate the people that voted no for giving us your sentiments on it. We did pass the motion. And as I've said for the last few weeks, since we went to phase one, this is a bit of an experiment. We have never been in this situation in our lives. And so I'm sure the lodgers are gonna try and be as careful as they possibly can. And we'll try and get the message out loud and clear that that people need to be very careful. All right. Police facility update. Will and Chief Holstein.
Thank you, City Council. So shifting gears from a very immediate public safety concern to a more long-term planning for the city's public safety needs over the next 40 to 60 years, we have site selection as the next step on our police space needs project. So I'm going to, I've got a PowerPoint here. I'm going to share my screen. Let's see, Jonathan, can you enable screen sharing for me?
You should have that ability, Will. Let me get you a co-host just in case.
All
go ahead and try again.
Great, thank you. Okay, so if the council will bear with me, I'm gonna go through a fair bit of background just because this has been a multi-year project with kind of sporadic touch points with city council. And since that time, we've had new councilors come, and then there's always, audience that may not be up to date on the project work that has gone on. And then I'll move into the site selection discussion and have next steps for the city council to consider. So this is the current police facility in the daylight basement of City Hall. It's in a 100-year-old building that is masonry construction that was some improvements with a remodeling, but really most of the remodeling improvements when city operations were consolidated in the current City Hall were focused on the upstairs with the intention that the police department would not be in this basement for very long. It has no backup power in case of emergency, and I don't know if everyone knows that it was originally the fire bay where police cars drive in now. That was a garage for fire engines that would go through where the fitness center is, and then the bays would be in the current shared office space where the chief's office is and desk area, and then be able to exit out where the entrance to the police department used to be garage door. Evidence processing is undersized, and this is not a police facility. This is a 100-year-old fire station, so there's no air filtration, and maintaining adequate chain of custody is a very manual process. This causes problems when we're weighing and dealing with evidence such as fentanyl or methamphetamines. Creates dangerous situation that is not ideal by any means. There's no secure facilities. So that means if anyone is in custody, they must be 100% every minute attended to by a police officer. So that if there's not anyone else in the station, you know, they can't write a report, make a phone call, or do anything that leaves them not in the presence of the in custody suspect. The same place where we would interview a suspect is also where we would interview a victim. There's no separation of space. And we don't have modern AV equipment for recording video and audio of interviews. Vehicle access is a sloped driveway that can become dangerous in hazardous weather. The weather can change quickly, so an officer might drive in to write a report, and then maybe some snow or sleet comes down, and now they have access. They have problems needing to get the snow off of their car before responding to a priority one call. And when responding to priority one calls, which is the lights and sirens types of calls, they need to back out of this sloped driveway with limited visibility onto State Street. The open air aspect of the driveway means that there's no anonymity for either suspects or for confidential informants. And transport into and out of the police station from the police car has no security, no controlled, there's no aspect of the physical space that's controlled. We do not have any meeting or training rooms. So we have to send officers to training rather than if we had space, we could bring trainers into the city and save on travel expenses for our police officers. And or we rent space, for instance, from the school district sometimes to perform trainings, which just limits how easy and convenient it is to maybe do a quick training session. The same place where we would interview a victim or a suspect is also has to hold formal meetings with, say, district attorney or opposing counsel. It's just not a professional space that includes a lot to hold these type of meetings with lawyers or other formal meetings. That's also the place where officers might take a nap or there's also our do laundry. There's no lockers or quiet space. So officers, if they get soiled uniform, depending on the severity, you know, they may have to drive home, and many of our officers live out of town because of housing costs. So maybe, you know, that could be any number of things that you come into contact in the field. If it's bad enough, like blood or something like that, they'll have to hope that they brought a change of clothes or borrow clothes from another officer while they do laundry in the same room that is, again, the primary meeting interview interrogation room. If that room isn't available to take a nap between overtime shifts or ahead of having to give testimony, often our police officers need to take naps in their personal vehicles because we don't have a quiet area for them to set aside and rest, which sometimes they'll work maybe 12 plus hours and then have about 3 hours until they have to go give testimony in court. Storage is undersized and the systems are outdated. New records, tools help with space saving and better organization of our records. And so those are some of the key deficiencies outside of just also being too small for our number of officers. So recognizing that we had deficient space, the City Council prioritized moving forward a police space needs analysis in 2018, and it was budgeted later in 2019. And we went through a competitive selection process and chose McKinsey Architecture, who say is the highest volume. They're the most experienced public safety facility architects in in Oregon, and put together this project plan to first calculate the size of our facility, tour other facilities to get us to educate our command staff, as well as we have Mayor McBride and Councillor Saunders on our team as council representatives. And so we've gone through those first two steps, and now we're on site evaluation. Once we choose two sites, Scope has us do preliminary site plans for two of the sites, and then we'll choose one, go into design refinement, creating floor plans, and perspective renderings, calculate facility systems like AC, HVAC, and then get cost estimates that are sufficient for moving forward a bond campaign eventually. So starting with that space needs program, it's based on population projections from Portland State University, which has our urban growth boundary growing from about 10,000 today to over 13,000 in 2040. And so we project out what those staffing needs would be to service that population in 2040. We know that this facility is going to last more than 20 years though. So really what we're doing is we're trying to tailor a facility that will perfectly fit our force size in 2040. So essentially where it's going to be too big for us in 2020, and the purpose of that is so that it perfectly fits us in 2040. And then we'll be in a similar situation in 2060 as we're in today, needing to start looking at building another replacement facility. So with those calculations, what we did was we kept the police department personnel to population ratio flat. And doing that, you get the size for needed for the officers that work in the facility, as well as shared space, shared facilities like locker rooms, meeting space, and holding sales. And all that added up to just over 16,000 square feet that was recommended by the architects. From that point, the project team toured similar sized facilities in Sandy, a substation in Gresham, and a new facility in Canby to get a better sense of what a new modern policing facility looks like. So we went through with the architects and met with representatives of each one of those agencies so they could talk about their experience, what they learned through building a new police department. And we got lists of what we wanted to emulate, what we wanted to avoid. And with that knowledge, worked through each individual space, shaving off anywhere that we felt that we could trim the space down a little bit. Construction cost estimates are coming in more than $500 a square feet, $750 a square feet may not be that unlikely. So obviously anywhere we can pare down saves the city quite a bit of money. And so we got to a final space program of just over 13,000 square feet, and that was adopted by City Council and moved us on to site selection, which is where we are today. Before I move into site selection, any questions on how we got to where we are today? I don't want to leave anyone behind. No? Okay. So we used the International Association of Chiefs of Police site selection criteria. And this is kind of the whole list right here, but it mostly boils down to functionality, access, cost, and whether or not the site can facilitate a public safety building. We looked at, we're gonna go through these sites, and I'm gonna quickly say the pros and cons of each. We're starting from the least, from a scoring standpoint, the least attractive sites to the most attractive sites. First we looked at was the Public Works Yard. The plus is it's publicly owned, but it's owned, at least this section of it is owned by Hood River County. Centrally located, if you were to draw a bullseye into the middle of the city, irrespective of downtown, this is roughly right in the center of town. And it's close to fire EMS, but it's not as close to our other buildings as one of the other sites that we're gonna look at later. The major cons are we don't have site control, so we would be dependent on the county, which means that we would need to move them and reconfigure the public works yard, which makes an indefinite amount of time that would take, that we would then continue to be in a suboptimal facility. Public access into this public works yard, especially on a 24/7 basis, is not safe. There's a lot of heavy machinery, things that are not secured. It's a working, public works yard for both the Hood River County and us, and definitely bringing people in at all times of the night would create security and safety issues that we would need to work out with the county. And the uses on here are akin to heavy industrial, and this has been used for fleet and heavy machinery for decades. So there's quite potentially some environmental damage to the area that would need remediation and add potential significant costs and risks to this site. We also looked at the current city hall to see if it could be reconfigured in any way. Obviously it's publicly owned and city owned, so we have full site control. It retains its connection to city administration, and we utilize downtown parking instead of needing to build off-street, more impervious off-street parking. The major downside is City Hall will not have the same lifespan as this brand new building. It's has or will very soon reach its 100-year anniversary. We will still have all the deficiencies, or many of the deficiencies will remain even after what would be a pretty expensive construction project, kind of glomming on a brand new facility onto a 100-year facility. We wouldn't have secure vehicle access. It would not meet the full space needs, the full 13,000 square feet requirement. So that's why it's one of the lower ranked sites as well. Going out to a greenfield site, basically the exact opposite of City Hall, we looked at this parcel out in the west side of town, where the population growth is occurring. This is good in many ways. It's flat, developable, good freeway access, very large, in fact, a little over twice the size that we need. That adds to cost as a downside, but also the plus that maybe we could do affordable housing parks or something else with the other part of this parcel. It is privately owned, so we'd have to purchase it. And it would be removed from the tax rolls, which has ongoing revenue considerations. And then I think one of the key things is we wouldn't actually be able to access Cascade Avenue because of the traffic volumes. And that is particularly as the city grows, traffic volumes increase, and if a roundabout is put in there. If a roundabout at Mount Adams and Cascade Avenue was put in, it would create a very smooth traffic flow. So you, in an emergency setting, you wouldn't be able to do a very quick left in or left out from the site to Cascade Avenue. So that means we would need to build a ramp up to access the site from Wine Country in and out primarily. Another major problem with this site is there's no on-street parking to accommodate peak parking needs. So like if we had a training or a public meeting, anything that brought building occupancy to its maximum, 100% of that would need to be housed off street, making a very large surface parking lot, because there's no parking on Cascade Avenue or Wine Country where people could park and walk, like how there are with some of our other sites. Next up is we looked at building over top State Street. So this one actually wouldn't lose too much parking as long as we were okay with the public and people with parking passes parking underneath our public safety facility. It would be quite expensive, but possible to build on stilts and have the entire building be second story. But there is no way to fit in a Sallyport, which is one of our stated needs. And obviously building on stilts and potentially up into a hillside makes the project pretty expensive. So not the most efficient from a cost standpoint.
Will, I have a question. I should know this and I don't. What's a Sallyport?
Oh, okay. That's the secure in and out. That solves the ramp issue that we have. It's basically a locked, secure garage, very big, locked, secure garage. So you can take in-custody suspects from the car into the building without being open to the public.
Bill, can I ask a question? There would be no access from Sherman Ave to the State Street property?
No, Sherman Ave is way above. Really much, much higher. I don't know how many feet, but I think 20, 30 feet above State Street.
Above State Street, but like to the second floor of, if we had a building there? Or?
No, I don't know if there would be any benefit either, because that's a pretty narrow, residential street without great access back onto, without very quick access back onto other major streets. Next up is one that is pretty ideal, except for one fatal flaw. It would be putting it right next to the fire station. That's a great location near to our other facilities, publicly owned, so we're not taking land off the tax rolls. The major piece that has taken it off of our recommended list is that the current facility is so deficient, and we have an opportunity to continue on the fire bond when it expires in 2022, having a bond election anytime before that, to have a no cost continuation of bonding authority. And the fact that we don't want to leave the police department in its current situation for what could be another 5 or 10 years, is that the pool is there and we don't know of any concrete timeline that it's going to move. I understand that the budget committee for the pool has chosen not to go for a levy or a bond to move the pool in November 2020. And they're going to wait to see how the COVID situation pans out before making their next moves. So this puts us ties our ability to have a modern police facility on an entity that we don't have control over and doesn't share our mission. Leaving us to what is the best from a point of view of the most good. Not ideal by any means, but we all know how constrained land and location is here in Hood River. We have Cascade Lot, which is our smallest lot. It's too small to ever house a multi-level parking garage. So essentially its level of the intensity of its use is capped at being a surface lot. If it's not changed into something else, it can never be anything more than that as long as it's parking. It's retains general proximity to City Hall and certainly is right in the middle of downtown. While it would lose about 45 parking spaces, about 40 to 50, that could be paired with, we have been setting aside urban renewal funds to potentially do a parking garage that has been in discussion for more than, I'd say, 10 years. And we've always kind of been on the bubble. And if we were to build a police station on Cascade Lot, it would certainly move us to knowing clearly if we should use urban renewal Cascade district funds to build a parking garage kitty corner in the Columbia lot. But obviously removes a central parking lot that people appreciate having a very close proximity to their buildings, and nobody likes to ask their customers to walk an additional block, which it would be the case if the parking garage was moved, you know, one block northwest. So next steps. Are there any questions about the sites maybe specifically before I go on to next steps? No? Okay.
Wait, I do. I believe that we reviewed this a couple of months ago, and wasn't the police station originally, the idea was that it would be on top of the tennis courts and not the swimming pool, or I could be completely wrong.
Oh, we're moving, that's in next steps.
Gotcha. All right, jumping the gun.
So I'll go to that. So we have these six sites, which are the ones that we currently thought of. And so it would be the status quo contract scope that we approve to tonight select two of them to go into a next level of design, which is like block designs, and then bring that back to choose one to go into design refinement. However, if clearly there's only one site that we want to move forward with, we can move directly to design refinement and save about $1,000 in contract costs. And that would then move directly into floor plans, perspective drawings, exterior character, and materials, and on to the next steps of cost estimation and a final report. We could, in addition, if we wanted to look at additional sites to consider, you know, the major problem with the pool is we don't own it, but we do own a lot of other land in the May Street complex, including the tennis courts, Friendship Park, and Collins Field on East. So if we wanted to add a site to the six and make it seven sites that we're considering instead of six, McKinsey is happy to do that, and the cost would be just a little over $8,000 to our contract.
So Will, just before you move on from that, in order for Friendship Park to be a viable location for the police station, wouldn't we have to put that to a vote?
Not necessarily, and Councillor Mehta had that question as well. So the charter amendment says that we need to have a vote before disposing of a park. This would not be, so how that affected Morrison Park is that was being sold to the Housing Authority. This is retaining city ownership. We're repurposing a park. However, I think people, while that is a I think a technical reading of the language. I don't know if many people would buy that. And I think there would be quite a demand for, obviously a demand for a public vote if we were going to repurpose a park. And one would sort of occur naturally because we need a voter approved bond to build it. So we're already going to a vote of the public. So it kind of makes it a moot point because this entire project will need to be voted on by the public sooner or later.
Wouldn't that be true for the tennis courts as well?
Probably. Really anywhere else on May Street. That's the biggest problem with the whole rest of May Street that we own is recreational park use.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's been, seems to always come up that there's some discussion around, well, how can we co-locate with the fire department? And I think everyone wishes that 8 years ago we had and didn't just go for a fire levy and went for a public safety levy. Unfortunately, we can't change the past, and this building was not built to house more than the fire department or built to be easily expanded upon. However, if we wanted to sort of put that question to bed, McKinsey Architects are the people who built that building, so they know it very well. And they said they could look into, they don't think that the building wasn't made to really support much room, much additional weight on a second story, but they could look at whether or not they could build the police department over the fire bays or what it would cost to demolish the fire bays and rebuild them so that they could support a police department on top of the second story and or expand southward into that graded area to the south that goes up into Friendship Park, maybe a combination of all of the above. And so to do that, they would want to come out and have another day-long site visit, the same way that they did with the police department, to observe fire department operations and see where maybe current space could be reconfigured to give some space to the police department versus how much would need to be a vertical or horizontal expansion of the building. And that would be about $34,000. So those are the sort of options. So the staff recommendation is to move forward on the Cascade lot, and that's based on the criterion of wanting to have a date certain and a path certain to getting a police facility replacement complete.
Hey, Will, this is Mark.
Mm-hmm.
If the city was the owner of a certain railroad, what does that do to this math? And then my second not in here yet question is, there's that property that you can just see in your slide on the lower right. And is there other real property adjoining the, you know, West Cascade included purchasing property. Is there not a purchase property option in the May Street, 18th Street, Taylor Street area that would satisfy all those requirements at no change in cost?
Not that we're aware of. I'm not aware of any, was considering zoning streets and the size that would be necessary. I'm not aware of any around May Street that is privately owned that could be purchased.
Well, everything can be purchased. And we're in charge of zoning, so.
Yeah, and we could add more sites. Addition of another site on May Street, if the council has another site that they would like us to add instead, I think it would still be the $8,135 if that's the choice of the council.
I guess that's the discussion, right? So.
And with regards to the question about the city potentially purchasing a surface lot, I think that's kind of the point is the same that Will made, that any use of the Cascade lot could or would tip us into meeting some additional parking downtown, and it's always going to be less expensive to do a surface lot.
I guess jumping the gun, I'm just not a fan of Cascade Lot. So, but I'll wait till Kate says it's my turn. So.
Okay, Will, did you have anything else?
No, I'm ready to answer any questions and support your deliberation.
Okay. Neil, did you have anything? I just wanted to, you've been involved in this whole thing and.
I don't. I believe Will pretty much answered everything that we'd spoke about. So.
Okay. Why don't we just go around? I mean, the staff recommendation is to look at the site plan for the Cascade Lot. I mean, that's the staff recommendation. So why don't we go around and see what people think of that particular thing and any additional ideas or questions you have about another site that you might like also, or don't like Cascade, I guess, if you don't. Does anyone want to start? Tim?
Thanks, Mayor. I have, my first question is that I'm looking at the scoring criteria, Will.
Mm-hmm.
And noticing that there is a staff score and a McKenzie score that they differ, sometimes pretty significantly. Can you give me an idea of what the scores entailed and why they would differ?
Yeah, that was based on those International Association of Chiefs of Police standards. And it's not that like there's a hard score, like an 8 out of 10 means something or a 7 out of 10 means something. It's more about how do you rank them relative to one another.
Mm-hmm.
One reason why so it's graded on a curve, so to speak. And so one reason why the points may change is just because someone's a harder grader than another one, right? So the curve is a little different. But I think when you see the difference between I think a lot of the difference is due to the fact that we come to this project with totally different experience backgrounds. So they're looking at it from, they've done some work in Hood River, but they're not locals. They don't know the Hood River context, but they do know technical aspects of construction and site characteristics that we don't know anything about. But we know, oh yeah, that's actually a good spot for XYZ reason. And I'm sorry, I don't have great for instances or anecdotes there, but that's kind of the gist of it. And you'll see the pool had a great staff score, but it's still not staff recommendation because there's so many ways that you would get points that, yeah, scored off the charts, but it just hit that litmus test of, does it give us a reasonable expectation of project completion with any sort of known timeline? And that kind of knocked it out, even though we actually scored it pretty well.
So I guess my second question is, there was a lot of was mentioned in here about the cost of, or not cost of, buying property, which is obviously an important part of it. But was any consideration given to the assessed value of the property that we would be essentially giving up for to put, you know, I mean, there's probably differences in the assessed value of these different properties. Was any consideration given to that, or do we have any idea what that is?
Yeah, well, so I believe the only privately owned parcel was the one on West Cascade, which is undeveloped right now, so it doesn't have much taxable value right now. Certainly as the west side develops, that could have immense tax generation potential, depending on how it develops. But, you know, that's really an uncertain timeline and would be a lot of guessing about how it's going to develop.
How about for the city-owned properties?
Don't generate any tax right now.
No, I mean for their assessed value. What are they worth like in a real estate market?
I don't know if the assessor puts much effort or work into assessing city parcels because they don't generate any tax. There's no reason for them to.
We'd really have to do a real estate analysis to get at that. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that we did within the project.
No, and I can understand that. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that you know, building on a lot that we own is not without cost. We're actually using it for something, and then it can't be used for something else. So that's my point there. So some of those lots may be more valuable than others. And I guess another question that I have, and I guess this is probably for a question for Chief Holstein. How tied are you to the Sally Port?
It's one of those functions we'd like to see. It's really a safety issue with bringing officers in with suspects. And in lieu also, it's bringing victims in. There's times where victims like to come in, not being seen by the general public, to be interviewed. It's kind of an important aspect of it. Overall, it's a square footage, but overall cost as far as the building itself, it's a secured garage. You know, it's not a finished thing, very other than concrete. So I see that if you were going to look at 20 to 2060, it's definitely a necessity to have for future.
I don't know who to ask this question of. I guess I'm going to ask it, Chief Holstein. How do you feel about the prospect of co-locating with the fire station?
All along, if I was at the helm at the time where that proposal was offered the many years ago, I would have supported that 100%. I didn't get to make that decision at the time. I think that could have been a great emergency service campus is what I would consider it. Mm-hmm. But again, I had no say back then. We worked very well with the fire department.
Thank you. I guess one last question, Will. I mean, obviously, you know, there's these scores and, you know, but for some of the sites you're mentioning that they will be expensive to build on. Do we have any feel for that? I mean, isn't that part of the equation too? Is how expensive is the final project going to be at these various locations?
Right. Well, and to another fiscal constraint is how much can we put into this study? And at $50,000, the true cost, we only have cost estimation for one site, not all of them. But the architects were able to give us relative proportionality to one another based on their technical expertise. So they know this is an expensive site. This is a very expensive site. This is a not expensive site. But that's about what's in the scope of the contract for them at this stage in the project.
Yeah. Thank you. Those are my questions.
Megan?
Sorry, I'm going to just follow up on Tim's last question of, you know, so like State Street lot is a very expensive site to build. Is that, I just, for scale, would that be like it's $2 million more than like the West Cascade site, or we don't have any idea at all?
Once we start giving hard numbers, you know, that starts to zero in and become a place mark where it's, we really don't have, but so I think proportionality, you know.
Or, I mean, I guess so even proportionally, is it twice as expensive as the West Cascade lot or like a third?
If that becomes the key, if there's like a range that you're like, the council saying, well, we really like State Street unless it's 30% more expensive. If it becomes the decision criteria, I think we could go back to the architects and see what it would cost to flesh that out. And it might be worth it.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that point. Remember, we can still choose two sites and then get some of the answers to these questions as we move forward. If those are kind of go-no questions for you.
Mark, did you have your hand up?
I didn't, but I'm ready.
Oh, okay.
So I really like the State Street one. I would suggest that we don't need to have public parking underneath. And so if you just looked at that footprint as a building and then build the Sallyport in that space, so there's a combination of building and parking for the police underneath, but you know, so it's a two-story building, but I don't know if that, it seems like it would make it not quite as expensive. I guess it's a two-story building versus a one-story building, and so there's some added cost just from that. I really don't like the Cascade Lot one, and it's more of a, my objection is more of a psychology one, or maybe it's my own, that the police station and the city hall and other public functions should be near either, you know, near the core, but not the core. And that block is the middle of downtown. And it just doesn't feel right to me that that would be a big police station right in that middle. And I know you're going to say there's a post office right across the street from it, Mark. And that's the difference with that. But it just doesn't feel like that's where you'd want to put it. And I hate to say it's a feeling-based thing, but I like the edges of downtown, and I like the public safety campus up by the pool. You know, they're just one leak away from it being ours to have, pretty much. But that's my opinion.
Others? Jessica?
I guess some thoughts or some questions. On Mark's idea about State Street, it seems like do we have to provide some public parking on the property for the guests? No?
No, the current police station doesn't provide any public parking.
But that's not necessarily ideal. There's so many things that are unideal about the current police station, which is to say, I definitely agree. I support the idea of picking something that lets us move forward more quickly because of the conditions at the current police station, and also because of the opportunity for the fire bond expiring. 34,000 to assess the fire department moving on to the police, or the police moving on to the fire, seems kind of high. And I'm also not positive we would end up picking that option, but I know, I guess this is like a longer term idea for the community. So maybe I'm okay with that. I was intrigued by Will's comment about that the Cascade Lot is too small to fit a parking garage, so the use is capped at the surface lot. I guess the alternative to that would be that the city would sell it then to a private developer to do something. And that goes to Mark's comment about if we don't put a police station there, what would we put there? It sounds like the city, Mark would say the city wouldn't put anything. Those are my general rambling ideas right now.
Megan?
I'll ramble next, Jessica. I did, reading this, where I obviously none of the sites are perfect, and I didn't actually feel like there was one that really spoke to me as like, that's clearly the direction we should go. I do have some concerns with Cascade. I mean, we already got, you know, I don't know if you all saw Miko's email, and I suspect it's going to be a common sentiment of, even though it's only a block away, that Cascade Lot is beloved, doesn't seem like the right word for a parking lot, but more well-liked than the Columbia Lot, which I think will make a bond campaign more challenging than it probably needs to be. This is a crazy idea that kind of came up when Will was talking, but if we were talking about building a police station on one lot and therefore having to do a parking structure on the Columbia lot. Is there a way to just build a police station and a second story of parking just all on the Columbia lot? And then keeping Cascade?
And so we considered that. And why the downside there is that the Columbia is used for a lot of special events. So like Beer Fest and Saturday Market. So we were thinking that the council or the city would want to retain the ability to have that as an event space and not have, not use the entire space for parking in the police facility.
Yes, I've always assumed once we build a parking structure, it's not a nice event site anymore anyway. And maybe that's a wrong interpretation of a parking structure, but.
Yeah, I think the thought was to not use the entire space, but one, because that would be a pretty enormous parking garage, but just choosing the western or the eastern half of it.
That is news to me on what that plan was.
That's an interesting idea, Megan. I had assumed if we were going to put a parking garage there, that the whole top, there would be a second layer over the whole thing. You'd access it off of 7th, 6th or 7th, come in from that upper corner. So you wouldn't have to have, you know, one of these going around and around things in there. But I had always assumed it would be the whole lot if we put a second level on that one.
Maybe the top say that there's the event one, yeah.
And I shouldn't say that there's any intention or expectation built into, there's no discussions one way or the other. I guess that was my own internal thoughts. But if we wanted to add another site and instead of at May Street, but include some sort of configuration on Columbia, yeah, that could be an option as well.
I like that last option that Megan, I'm pointing at you, even though you're not next to me on my actual screen. I also just like the State Street as well. I think going for Cascade after just hearing what our chief has said, that's not preferable, that I don't think we should decide on that one based on the comment he just made. But I really like Megan's idea.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking. The chief said that the Cascade Street was a bad area. I'm not sure.
Just not having that Sallyport.
Oh, I think he was saying there would be no Sally. Oh, on State, not on Cascade. Okay.
Yeah, State Street is the one that doesn't allow the Sallyport.
Okay. Eric?
Well, I will acknowledge at the very beginning that others have thought about this more than I have. And I, by the way, appreciate the mayor and Megan being on the subcommittee. So I am completely persuadable. I will say my favorite ones were the ones sort of more toward the bottom. I like the public works yard because of actually possibly having a synergy with the sheriff's office in the county. I like the 3540 Cascade. Just because it was kind of a blank slate. But be that as it may, again, I'm persuadable. And I did share Councilor Zandmiller's concern about Cascade. It just seems like part of the magic of Hood River is, the business synergy you have, the windsurfing, and having the police station in literally kind of the smack downtown, right in the heart of town, just is a little bit inconsistent with the downtown planning and vibe we have. That actually made me think, too, I was feeling a little thirsty for more public input because our downtown business owners may have views on this. I know we've heard from some, but this is relatively new information. I'm thinking even of the Planning Commission may not get involved necessarily, but from a, like in Portland, they have these design review committees that think about the aesthetic of the community. And I'm just seeing that there's this aesthetic kind of square peg round hole with the Cascade lot. Now, if we were going to, and this is actually one of my questions, are we talking possibly, I mean, I've heard Will say it and I read it, there's this possible synergy with the parking garage, but I wasn't clear if we're like saying, yep, let's do these together, we're going to get a parking garage, or that's kind of a maybe thing for the future. If it's a maybe thing for the future, you know, those maybe things for the future, just practically speaking, tend not to happen in my limited experience with government. So I'm just concerned that that it just wouldn't happen. But if it's totally legit that we're going to actually have a parking garage as a part of that, I'm more open to Cascade. But I just think I personally don't have enough input from the business community and a sense of how it might alter the aesthetics of downtown to rally behind Cascade. Now, State Street, I see the attraction to that. And so that probably is toward the top of my list of projects or locations that other people are interested in as well. And I'll just say, relative to the pool one, I certainly appreciate Will's point that we just, there's too many uncertainties there. A point that I hadn't, that hadn't been made that comes to my mind too, is there's just a kind of a land use inconsistency in my mind with the middle school right there. And I just had this concern, you know, about the police driving at a high rate of speed out of there. They're just, there's like a little bit of a use incompatibility. Now, I know we have the fire department there and they've gotten along well, but I'm concerned about the kind of the closeness of the police with the middle school and those other park areas. So I would, you know, but the idea of, and no, I'm just rambling now, but the idea of getting in between Friendship Park and that little hillside, that's attractive to me, but I realize there's a cost component to even know if that's viable. So, and Councilor Mehta made a good point in that regard that resonated with me. So I guess in sum, I'm nervous about Cascade consuming that parking that we need, becoming the heart of downtown, being kind of government, which is important, but not the heart of who we are. I'm concerned about Cascade Locked, the Cascade Lot, and I guess it would be not unafraid to spend a little more money on State Street. We're sort of investing in the aesthetic of our downtown, so I think you can make a case of spending a little bit more to maintain better the aesthetic of downtown. But I keep a very open mind on all this, and again, would say I'd like to have more public input before firmly deciding on any of these.
I believe I'm confused. I thought State Street could have a Sally Port, and I just read that that is the site that cannot, correct? Okay. My bad.
So we did talk just earlier in this conversation that potentially if we remove the public parking from the lower part of State Street, that maybe that would allow a Sallyport, which might be where the confusion's coming in.
Right. Yeah. And that came to mind when Councilor Haney was talking. You know, we have in the contract two sites. There's maybe nothing to say that we can't sort of work that to be two configurations of one site if you wanted to see State Street on stilts and State Street used as the parking surface as a possibility.
And I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that we do still have this around $4 million for Cascade Urban Renewal, and a parking garage was contemplated with that money. And that's why we were talking about a certain potential railroad area if it came about, because a surface lot would be less expensive than a structure. But I think if we talk about either the Cascade lot or the Columbia Street lot, that for a police station, that we are talking about providing more parking. But we are talking about providing more parking in the long run from the parking study that we did last year. So I think we should just keep that. That is in our game plan. I mean, we are going to need more parking in the next, not that distant future. So I think we just need to keep in mind that is going to be happening either way in the future. We have to have more.
I think that's a good point, Kate, of we obviously need more as part of that plan, but that if anything in the downtown takes away parking, we have to commit to at least replacing what we'd be removing in some other form. If not, also then, you know, doing the combined project where we're adding more for the long range plan.
Right. It might push it forward faster, I guess, if we decide to take parking out. And we're going to do that in the next couple of years, that we need to be pushing other parking plan forward a bit faster. Did you have something, Rachel?
Well, I guess, Mayor, I was just kind of thinking through what I'm hearing, and I don't, we'll have to look at what our notes are. We're on the Columbia lot, and maybe we could do that, Will, and bring some information back on what we were thinking. There was a reason it fell off, but again, I'm just not reflecting on that. And it sounds like, based on the conversation here, that could be a decent option, and maybe something we need to do a little more homework on. So, I mean, what I'm really hearing is kind of State Street, you know, potential, and recognizing that we'd have to get the parking, fulfill the parking somewhere else, which we're going to do anyway. So State Street and this idea of the Columbia lot is kind of what I'm hearing, along with some additional public input, and there'll be a natural place for that as we get these designs refined.
I think that is kind of the consensus at this point. I understand why we picked Cascade as the number one, Cascade lot as the number one. We own it, it fits. We're going to do parking anyway somewhere else. We can do the Sallyport. I mean, it would be more economical, likely. But I also get it's right and smack dab in the middle. And not that a parking lot is necessarily the most beautiful thing right smack dab in the middle either. A bunch of cars on a piece of cement isn't that pretty. But just, you know, we have to consider what we could also get passed with the bond. So I think there is probably some considerations, because we have people voicing the opinion that maybe that isn't exactly the place we should put it, and we need to think about being able to pass a bond too. So I think that's kind of the consensus for now. Personally, I'd love the pool. That's the area I think is the best the best area, but it's constrained. I think that there could be a synergy between the police department and the middle school. Yes, I agree with you, Eric, about fast cars pulling out. I don't like that idea very well, but the fire engines pull out and the ambulances pull out already. But I think there could be a synergy between the chiefs, the sergeants, the whole staff there, and the middle school itself. So I don't think it's a bad spot for it, but we don't control it, so.
Mayor, do you mind if I just real quick, because that is something that comes up quite a bit, so I like to correct it every time it comes up, that police vehicles don't respond from a police station the same way they do from a fire station. So police vehicles are always patrolling the city, and then they go to where the calls for service are. They don't deploy from the office. Okay. So that's a major difference.
Thanks for that clarification. Mm-hmm. So do you kind of have a gist for where we're going and what we might want to do here? We've kind of picked, potentially it looks like maybe State Street and possibly Columbia Street. Is that?
Sure. It would be good to have maybe in a motion that we can reference as an official action. And then also, I believe we'll want flexibility to do the contract amendment to add contract authority for that additional site evaluation.
Okay. Did you guys want to look back at past notes of why Columbia might have been taken off the list in the first place before we say we want to pursue it further? Or
I know in my mind it was to protect it as a site, as an event site. But you know, if we want to look at a combined park, like a police department with a parking garage on top or something like that, you know, we could talk.
I don't think we need to wait on the direction. And as Will said, we'll need some, if Columbia is a viable option, you know, we'll need some, ability to adjust the contract. So we can get you back some information on that, but it shouldn't hold us up from moving forward.
Tim?
So Will, as far as the contract goes, were they supposed to evaluate two sites? Was that something that they were supposed to do and then we could add another site, or is that?
They're supposed to take what they've done already for the sites and bring two of them up to a next level of block design. You see right now we're in 2D, that up to 3D. But if we're gonna start where we don't have that 2D rendering to begin with a site from scratch, that's where I think we're gonna need the additional contract authority.
Right, which was, you estimated to be around $8,000 or $9,000.
That's what they quoted, yeah, $8,135.
So, but my question is, could we pick two sites, because that's part of the contract, and then evaluate the Columbia lot as an additional site? I mean, because it seems like we're going to have to pay for the additional part of it anyways, right? Do they owe us two sites?
They owe us bringing two of the six to a next level. But starting another seventh one from scratch, they said will cost a little over $8,000.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe we shouldn't just pick the State Street one. We should pick the State Street one and another one, and then we're going to have to pay for the Columbia lot evaluation anyways, right?
If we want to evaluate the Columbia lot, you could say State Street and any of the other five of the six, and also we could add Columbia lot for evaluation with that $8,135. Well,
does the $8,000 get us to like where these six sites are now, or does it get
exactly
us to? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So assuming we liked the 2D version of the Columbia lot, that would be one of our two sites to move forward to the next spot.
Yeah. Yes.
Do other people have a second site that they, you know, we've got the pool lot, but we don't have control of it. We've got public works, but there's all sorts of issues with that. Then we've got the thing that's clear at the other end of town, but probably going to be fairly expensive. So do we want to add one of those or not? I don't hear anyone saying we want to add Cascade, which was the first recommendation by staff.
I'm comfortable with Cascade Lot and State Street Lot, the two corners of downtown.
Do you mean Columbia Lot?
You mean Columbia? Okay.
Yes. Not Cascade Locks. I don't know why we're even talking about that.
We're going to take it over.
Jessica, did you have something?
I was going to echo Mark's comment.
So without seeing the like where these current six sites are with Columbia, I know it's an extra step of checking in, but could we see that and then potentially decide we want to pursue both Columbia and State to the next level, or we want to do State at the two different types of State to the next level, but like after seeing what they come up with for Columbia?
Yeah, I think the logical way to go from my discussions with the architects is if you want Columbia lot, we'll just go with a motion to add that. It's the second a seventh site, $8,135. We'll get Columbia up to speed with the rest of the six sites, so it's apples to apples. And then we can choose which two sites we want to take to block design.
That might be a good way to go with a motion. And then we've really discussed this very thoroughly. And so we could just start with that block design for the next discussion. And hopefully we could get through the discussion in 20 minutes at another meeting to go forward with that, or to do two designs on State Street maybe.
Yep. So the next thing we would bring you is just Columbia lot in 2D, so it's apples to apples with the other six sites. And then from there, we would choose which two to take to block design. Did I say the same thing you said?
Yes. Now? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do I have a motion for that?
I move that we ask the consultant to take the Columbia lot to the 2D level. of analysis.
Okay, I have a motion.
I'll second.
Tim second. Discussion? Eric?
Madam Mayor, just very briefly, I'm in favor of this for two reasons. First, Tim was basically encouraging us to be good consumers, and I think we can sort of get there and solve his problem, make sure we're not losing out on a 3D diagram by sequencing it that way. And secondly, this will give us some more time for some public input, because this is relatively new to me, so I have to think it's new to the community. So I'm in favor of the motion.
Okay. Additional discussion?
I just have a question. Yes. So when would we see that 2D image of Columbia? Would it be for like a month from now, 2 months from now?
So I'm speaking for the consultants right now. So can't hold me to this timeline, but I think they can turn that around pretty quick. I think we could have that to you within like two city council meetings.
I just want to make sure that we add time for public input. So that's what I was asking. Thanks.
Yeah, this will be on the radar of people now since we've had this meeting. I mentioned it on the radio with Mark Bailey this morning that we were going to be discussing it, and we had a lot of information and pictures in our packet that people could look at it online. So I mentioned that today on the radio this morning.
Yeah, and just so we know what to expect in terms of public input, you know, we can do some social media, we have a website, the project is on a website, but we would not be doing any kind of roundtables or anything like that, open houses, nothing like that, because there's going to be so much, opportunity as this moves forward, but we can certainly let the downtown businesses know that this was on the agenda and where they can find more information.
Mark?
Question, so would we bring how many drawings go to the bond effort? Is it one drawing, this is what we want to build, or is it A or B? It's one, okay.
Okay, I have a motion on the table. Roll call, vote, Megan?
Yes.
Jessica?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Gladys?
Yes.
Chair votes yes. All right, great.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, we're going to adjourn the work session. It is 8:30. We'll open the regular council meeting. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No, we do not, Mayor.
Okay. We have a consent agenda, which includes consideration of approval of the collective bargaining agreements for Police Association and the Public Works Association is our first item. And OLCC application for Rommel's. Any questions regarding consent agenda? Okay, do I have a motion?
Tim, did you have a question?
I did have a question, actually.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Tim. I just kind of got in there under the wire.
Oh.
I did look at the various contracts, and it seems like the whole point of it was to kind of roll it over to next year because of the situation. But I also noticed that there was a bunch of edits in there, and I'm just wondering who made those edits and what are they for?
Yeah, thanks very much for the question, Counselor. We started bargaining with Police and Public Works prior to COVID happening. So there were some edits that we were able to make. Most of them incorporate changes in the laws. So laws related to the Janus decision that passed with regards to union dues. And then there was some, you know, kind of Oregon Family Medical Leave and Family Medical Leave Act laws, those types of things that we needed to incorporate. So that was the bulk of it, but again, we kind of put all of it on hold. So what you see are some contracts that you know, definitely have more to talk about, but were put on hold basically because of the situation.
Great, thank you. Do I have a motion on the consent agenda?
So I move we approve the consent agenda.
Megan's made a motion.
I second.
Gladys has seconded. Additional discussion? Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Megan?
Yes.
Gladys?
Yes.
Jessica? Mark?
Yes.
Chair votes aye. Regular business, safe routes to schools. Jonathan.
Yeah, Jonathan's going to make
it. Alrighty. Well, I have a short presentation just to help. Since I'm a GIS analyst, I make maps. Visual aid is kind of how I talk. So bear with me while I click. Alrighty. Will this play ball with me tonight? Nope. Okay. We'll do the old school way. Alrighty. Well, Madam Mayor, council members, thank you so much for letting me talk today. I get to talk about some lighthearted but very important business here at the city. So what we're talking about tonight is how the city is making progress in the Safe Routes to School initiative within the 2020 work plan. The city of Hood River has organized a small work group to develop and implement what has become a three-phased program to expand existing bicycle and pedestrian networks. Specifically tonight, the implementation of phase one and conceptual outlines of the remaining two phases. Currently, Public Works Street Crew have ordered and are preparing to apply 18 sharrows across what is Wilson and A Streets. What this will do is it'll create the first dedicated route connecting the east-west sides of the Heights area for students traveling from the middle and May Street schools. The Wilson A Street corridor was chosen after city and staff had considered each possible crossing location along the Heights Business District for safety and visibility while upholding City Municipal Code Section 10.48.020, which prohibits a cyclist's use of sidewalk in commercial zones. So the Wilson and A Street crossing is the only area in the Heights that has continuous crossings of 13th and 12th Streets, State Highway 281. City Engineering had also recommended a continuous bike corridor that would minimize exposure along state highways and other high traffic corridors to maximize child safety and cyclist safeties. I want to mention really quickly that any improvements to existing crosswalk signage is a feature that will require further discussion and coordination prior to action. The work group also decided that any generalized bike route signage should be deployed once a complete route has been established. So to let you know where we are right now, previous orders from the supplier have arrived 2 to 3 weeks after ordering, and the street lead has estimated about 4 days of staff time to apply for this job. So about middle of June is when we can expect phase one to be completed and painted on this 8-9 block section of town. So this Wilson A Street corridor is just the first phase of the proposed concept. Phase two expands it to the newer growing neighborhoods south of Indian Creek, the Elliott Park and Mountain Vistas area.
Hey, Jonathan, can I interrupt and go back to phase one just for half a second?
Absolutely.
I couldn't tell whether are the crossings on 12th and 13th included as part of that, or is it just the sharrows?
Councilor, the sharrows will be crossing at 12th and 13th. Because they are state right away, we have to figure out a way to improve upon those cross marks if we want to. So kind of a yes and a no answer, if I will. I do know that Public Works did recommend, and we probably will implement compact car parking signs on the first two stalls north of the 13th Street crossing, just to increase visibility.
No bump outs yet or anything future. This is trying to get safely across those two streets, but sort of what it looks like now, is that the gist?
At this point in the phase, absolutely, yes, you are correct. We didn't have the breadth of planning and implementation ability and coordination to work out bump outs or light signage of any sort at this phase. I don't think anyone is against investigating that further, but again, that'll have to be at a later phase. Right now, we're just looking at painting the streets and designating a route, creating a route.
Are those crossings are at least the ones that are approved by ODOT and were improved last year?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are we good to continue?
Jonathan, I have one question.
Yes, absolutely.
Do the sharrows go in the center of the street, or do they go on, you know, each direction? Is there two of them on the street, basically where each lane is of traffic?
Absolutely. They are planning to be on in the direction of flow on his side of the street, usually at the beginning of the street in that direction. So, gosh, that was a horrible description. I'm sorry. So if you were traveling westbound on Wilson, crossing 12th and going in between 12th and 13th, you would have a Shero at the beginning of Wilson at 12th and A, or 12th and 13th. And at the end of the block would have another Shero pointing the opposite direction.
Okay.
With traffic.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so phase two. I want to make sure that I stress that phase two is in a conceptual plan phase. It's preliminary. We have more or less pointed out the most realistic routes with what we have, right? You know that we have the streets south of Pacific, but we feel that that's, but it really is just a little bit difficult to expect children to travel multiple blocks in the opposite direction, get on the 281 sidewalk shoulder, and then travel back from where they came from. We know that children would go on Pacific Avenue. So that's where we're going to probably look at. There is a little bit more information in my packet regarding phase two. But really it's just a conceptual idea of connecting Mountain Vistas and Elliott Park with the school zones to the north by crossing Indian Creek, with a potential partnership with Parks and Rec, just in that little couple block section where all pedestrian traffic is funneled onto 12/281.
Jonathan, that area where you would be coordinating with Parks and Rec, would that be some kind of an improvement to the Indian Creek Trail in that area where it swoops down and goes over the actual Indian Creek? Or would it be some kind of cantilevered thing up by the sidewalk or what?
The concept that Public Works and I have come to really encourage is improving that section of trail and improving the access road that city uses for the pump station up to Union and then carrying on to the Wilson Avenue. So it would be taking children and pedestrians off the street for about that two block section with improvements. I'd you know, between potential lights, surface improvements. But again, that would be coordination with Parks and Rec, since it is their space and it does cross into private land too. Are there any other questions about phase two? I know it's very vague, but that's about where we are in phase two.
When, I mean, you're putting the paint on the road for phase one, what's the timing for phase two? I don't know if I saw it in here or not.
No, that you didn't see that in there because we haven't landed on a timeline for phase two. Phase one's happening right now because it is a very cut and dry actionable item, and we wanted to make use of the quiet streets as best as possible. You know, we have a bad situation nationwide, worldwide, but it gives us an opportunity to do some improvements while folks are staying home. If we're all right, I'll move on to an even briefer phase three here. Phase three, again, is a very preliminary conceptual idea of how we can join the northern neighborhoods, and that is Wasco, south to Oak Street, with the schools that are in the Heights. There are no schools down in the downhill northern part of town. They're all up in the Heights. How do we get children there if we want to encourage them not to drive constantly, cut down on traffic? At the same time, we do know that the Historic Columbia Highway bike path is coming to town, and there's an opportunity to try and work together to create one concise bicycle network instead of multiple veins of bicycle mark lanes through town and solve the same problem. And honestly, that is exactly where this phase three is sitting right now is, we know we want to do something at that part of town. This makes the most sense at a eagle eye view, at this map scale view, but we need to talk with all the shareholders and stakeholders and different agencies involved in that area, in that project.
My only comment on that is that 20th Street is gonna be a grind.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, I do not like riding my bike up that.
No, I don't either.
but at present state, the alternative would be sending children through downtown, which would be a horrible concept in my opinion. Again, this is my opinion.
Yeah, I know.
There, you know, maybe in future West Side development plans, something can be done in that case. But right now, working with what we have at hand, the Eagle Eye View concept really points to 20th Street to Columbia. Columbia is entirely residential down to Full Sail. Wasco is a very industrial street. Lincoln does not go through, and Cascade intersection is less safe, to put it bluntly.
Hey, Jonathan.
Yes, sir.
We've had some very informal discussions about an alternate historic highway connection along Westcliff instead of down the heart of Cascade Avenue. I wonder if your phase three couldn't include markings, you know, basically from, you know, the historic hotel along Westcliff underneath the 20th and connect to this? Or is that a completely different topic?
No, that very well could work. You know, I have just recently started working with planning this bicycle concept, and I know that members of the planning department are starting to work on the bicycle connection. But again, like just like you said, it's very at early stages. I do not see why it couldn't potentially work together. You know, ultimately the concept would be to have a unified, fully sensical bicycle route through town. We're a bicycle town. Part, you know, we If you don't come to Hood River for the water, most people come here for wine and biking. So let's grow our bicycle infrastructure, right? It makes sense. But that comment is also a really good segue to my second to last segment here. And that's just a reminder that bicycle networks cost money. They cost money to put on the ground the first time. They cost money to repair and maintain throughout the entire longevity of that system. So the more that we put down, the more it costs in crew hours and material, right? So again, it leads us to having a really well thought out transportation system plan, you know, TSPs being relooked at, but also looking at it through the lens of safe routes to school. They should work together, and they are going to be working together, you know. So it's just a reminder. The values up here are quoted from our public works employees. So each sharrow as of last month cost $206. It's 18 of those for the Wilson. So it is just about a $3,000 project before time. Fortunately, streets are a little bit more quiet. They may not need a four-person crew, but that is not up to me to decide. That is up to the streets lead to decide. So that could be four employees working for 4 days, you know, to put down that $3,000 worth of material. And that's just for 8 blocks. So, yes.
Jonathan, our existing network is 1 to 2 weeks of annual repair. Just for scale, like phase one would add 2 days to that, 1 to 2 weeks, or yeah, a week, or what?
I think this is something that we can accomplish within existing resources with phase one. If we get into, you know, the Indian Creek Trail and whatever we end up on Pacific, then I think we can talk about what appropriate maintenance looks like. But just adding this phase one network is something we can accomplish within existing resources.
So like existing repair would still be the 1 to 2 weeks range?
Yeah.
Yeah, Public Works Express.
Perhaps a couple of days more, but this is something we can do.
I appreciate it's something we can do. Just for my scale of what we're doing, it's helpful to have the number of potentially a couple of days more.
Thank you. I don't see why it would take any longer. Right, you know, so the quote was 4 days for a fresh implementation. Assuming once a year, you don't have to replace all full 18 pieces, so that's maybe a 2 day extra commitment for this stretch of land. So, you know, between a 2 and 4 day, but again, that is a quote that would have to come from our streets department. They would know best.
And I would assume a lot of that would depend on weather. If we didn't have to put down a lot of gravel, we didn't have a lot of snow plowing, you know, we could easily go 2 years on all of it. But if we had a whole bunch of that, we'd probably have to replace a lot of them.
That is very correct, yes. Yeah. They made it very clear that weather is a huge factor. Weather is the factor of why we have to replace them every 2 years is, on average, they just get destroyed by then. Plows, traffic, and gravel, ice, you have it, yep. So my last slide here, I'm gonna get to the meat and potatoes of why I'm here tonight. Tonight I'd like to ask council to approve and adopt this map. It's found on page 101 of the packet tonight. This is to serve as the foundation of the city's safe routes to school. Once adopted, this map will help guide future grant requests and capital improvement plans concerning this topic. The current version of the map will be enhanced and expanded as further community development occurs, and success of this network will only come with awareness and education. The map attached is a presentation, is a draft of this working group's ideal outcome for phases 1 through 3. This official Safe Routes to School map can then be shared with educators and families in our community to help improve awareness and guide their children safely to and from school.
Great, thank you. Does anyone else have any questions for Jonathan?
This is Megan. I guess two questions. One, the phase two and phase three colors on the map, I cannot distinguish. So I'm wondering if we could fix that.
Absolutely, yes.
Awesome.
yeah. You know, when a map of this nature goes to print, the first thing that I would look at is line thickness and line weight and color appropriation. Color graduation is important, and I don't want to go off the rails with map nerd talk, but yes, we'll check for readability and color sensitivity too.
Awesome. And then I guess just, you know, big picture, this clearly looks good to me. And I guess what we adopt tonight doesn't mean that we couldn't make some edits in the future if, you know, like Mark's idea of using Westcliff becomes more reality or somehow 20th Street is no longer the correct answer. This is a good thing for right now, and we can make edits and adopt a new map if needed in the future.
Yes, absolutely. This is a working map, a proposed map.
And I think to your point, Counselor and Jonathan, we may not even put the phase three on there. You know, if we get to a map that we're going to publish for the community, that's just, I think you raised some really good points tonight, and there's a lot more work to do. I think this is a draft to get us started and moving on this project.
Thank you.
Jessica?
So I'm super excited about this project. I've especially been riding around with my little kids on bikes a lot around this whole area. I think the phase two will be super helpful because we have done the thing where we're riding our bikes on 12th and it's terrifying on the sidewalk, which we're not supposed to do. So hopefully Chief Holsey's not listening anymore. One of the things I was going to point out is on the phase three, besides 20th being just really difficult to ride your bike up, so maybe people wouldn't do it, there's actually not a continuous sidewalk on either side of that street. As somebody that's walked up that hill, both sides, whatever side you're on, there's going to be a block where you're just like walking in the dirt or walking in the road. And I know this is bicycle upgrades, but I feel like it could be, if we're going to talk about phase three, then maybe we could like build a little bit of sidewalk, which was something that I talked about earlier that I would like to do for having all of our main streets have continuous sidewalks.
Absolutely. That makes complete sense, especially under the banner of Safe Routes to School. If we're going to be guiding children, not all of them are going to be on bicycles, and it makes sense to have one route and not multiple routes. So, yeah, we can definitely amend phase three. And as Rachel mentioned, we can probably remove all of phase three until further down the development line, not to give any false advertising for sure.
Okay, additional, Tim and then Eric.
Yeah, I have a question about the area near May Street and Hood River Middle School on May Street as it crosses 12th and 13th. It seems like the arrows are not connecting there. Is there a reason for that?
That is because they do not currently connect. That intersection is a known hotspot, a trouble spot in town, and is going to require significant planning and work with the state to try and redesign. When I met with the work group with engineering and public works, we spent a lot of time debating that area on feasibility, and it just never worked. It's just too congested currently.
As far as a planning document, though. I think that we should have something in there. I mean, I can understand feasibility and the like, but I mean, it's really, there are so many kids going back and forth through that area. I don't see how we could possibly ignore it. I mean, it's one of the most, you know, I know for the folks that live in the neighborhood that I do, it's very important to them. And I would expect, you know, for the folks that live on the west side of town and have kids that want to get to May Street, that it's really a big trouble spot too. So, you know, phasing in some way or the other, I think something should be there to...
Yeah, Councillor, I think that's a great point. Yeah, we need something there. Jonathan and I will talk about that. There has to be some way, just like we're creating a way for the kids to get across on Wilson, there has to be a way for kids to get across from the May Street side over to the middle school. Absolutely. We'll take a look at that.
Thank you.
I think I've kind of... looked at this like the blue lines are the ones that are already there that already have markings. And, you know, it's so obvious. It looks like, well, why don't those things connect? You know, as Tim says. But I guess I'm thinking that this is the 2020 stuff we're working on now, which is phase one is the green line and phase two is the, you know, purple line. And that should be in there, but it's not a phase that we're doing right now. You know, it might be phase five or phase six, because there's so much more planning and cost that's going to be involved in it. It's not that we aren't going to do it eventually, but I'm not sure how to distinguish that kind of a thing on here. Like, yes, we need to connect that, but it's not, we're not to phase 10 yet or something.
How about a big, how about a big danger symbol over the area?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Yeah, I think we can figure something out.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. And thank you, Ms. Mayor. That is exactly on point. It's on the books, but it's down the road outside of this concept.
Eric, did you have something?
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I had, a comment / point of encouragement and a question. So I was encouraged, and my comment is on the, for phase, I think it's phase two, but from basically where Dutch Bros is kind of headed north, I can tell the line is off 12th on that trail. And that, I find that encouraging because it is such a dangerous area. And I know that requires some private ownership partnership, but I'm just encouraged to see that we're maybe creating some inertia to have that be a robust thoroughfare for bicycles. Because I just think that is so much better than kind of the ODOT controlled 12th Street. And I, you know, long-term, that's probably going to require some, probably not radical, but some capital improvements. I know as you go up to Dutch Bros on that heavy gravel, it can be hard to manage, particularly with a child, but I guess I was just encouraged to see that purple line the way it was. And my question, and it goes to one of your earlier comments, and then sort of like Councillor Mehta, I actually have children, we bicycle, my kids might be a little older than Jessica's, but you mentioned that you're not supposed to ride your bikes on sidewalks in commercial. And I wondered if the inverse is true. Are people allowed to ride their bicycles in residential areas on the sidewalks? Because there just is an inclination as a bike rider, when you have children in particular, to be on the sidewalks because it feels safer. And just forgive me for not knowing. I'm just wondering if you know what the city's position is in terms of sidewalks in residential areas.
Sure. In the city's municipal code, it did not speak against residential bicycle sidewalk use. It only spoke against commercial zone use. So if
thank you.
That helps, that is as far as the city municipal code spoke to bicycle traffic.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have... does someone want to make a motion to approve our improvement plan, the map for our Safe Route to Schools improvement plan for this spot in time? Gladys?
I move to adopt the proposed Safe Routes to School Maps to school map and direct staff to begin implementing an improvements as outlined.
Thank you, Gladys.
Nice. I'll second it.
Mark seconds. Anything else on that? Okay, Gladys?
Yes, thank you for the presentation, Jonathan.
Megan?
Yes.
Jessica?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
Tim?
Yes, thank you for the presentation.
And I vote yes. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me tonight, and we'll get
great. Thank you so much. All right. Last but not least, Chief Damien.
Good evening. So Honorable Mayor and City Councilors, this evening before you is an IGA that the city's attorney helped draft. This is the genesis of this is back in November of this last year. We were informed by our distributor where we order medications that we can no longer order what we need. They're going to only send things in the packaging that it comes out in. So this is a requirement from the FDA, and it was just a slow trickle of changes that caught up to us from 2013 to 2019. But the impact to the organization is if we just need two things and we get a package of 12, a good example would be is we spend $300, we only need $50 worth of medication and potentially have to waste $250 of medication if we don't happen to use it. And the trickle down is Cascade Locks, who also runs an ambulance, Parkdale, who also runs an ambulance, and the other fire districts that carry medications, though not all of them, are all in the same predicament. So each one of these organizations, if it was the same medication, the cost of the system would be nearly $2,000. If we're the only organization that happens to use two of the medications, the waste to the system on just one medication, depending on how long the shelf life is, would be about $4,000. And we carry upwards of 40 medications, and we carry those on three ambulances. And you can just do the math through the whole county. And it's a large financial impact to our organization, for us and for everybody else. And so we had met this past fall once we had the notice that this was a change. We came up with a framework for the IGA. Dan Cairns helped draft this. It was vetted through their council as well as their fire commissioners. They have overwhelming approval for us to move forward with this. And we have some logistic issues still to work through, this is something we can easily handle, especially in place of we're doing the SCBA stuff for the county now, and that's slowly gonna be taken away from us, which is a great thing, and replaced with something that is more regionally approached. So we're looking for a regional solution and trying to be a good partner to all these agencies and help save the system and our taxpayers money, because on the front end, we pay for the medications, and in the end, we still have to waste the medications if they go bad. And that's a bad thing to have a lot of waste in the system. So we've looked at this through the DEA for approval. There's no issues because we're a super small county and a small agency doing the distribution. We're still responsible for all the paperwork and all the logistics that surround that. There'll be a small charge both on the outgoing medication as well as the waste of the medication. So the city's not paying for any of the time, manpower, logistics for us to take care of this. And in the end, like I mentioned earlier, it's going to save our region, definitely cost for each agency to be better stewards of our tax dollars. So thank you. Open for any questions.
Thank you, Chief. Boy, it sounds like a great program. Questions, anyone?
Not a question, but okay.
Eric?
Okay, really quick question. So I wondered if you could just speak to the inclusion of Mosier. I'm not used to seeing Mosier in our sort of immediate world of these IGAs. There's the physical proximity. I assume that's it. But I wonder if you could just speak to the presence of Mosier. It just looked unusual to me.
Mosier is part of our ambulance service area. So there are partners. Oftentimes they respond obviously with us, should they have volunteers, they have several paramedics that are also volunteers. So this is in part for us to restock their medication should they use it. That's one. Two, because we run to Mosier more than any other ambulance service provider. So that's a Wasco County ASA 1. That's our service area. Mid-Columbia Fire does not service that area unless we cannot. So we're their primary response agency, and we felt best to be a partner for them.
Thank you very much.
And we currently do their air pack servicing like we have been. So it's just a natural inclusion within our service area.
Thank you.
Megan?
Oh, I just wanted to say thanks to the chief, and I guess to Dan of the IGA. I had a bunch of questions about admin costs and us potentially being on the hook for disposal, and the IGA addressed all of that and seems like it's going to work out fine for us. And it seems like a good program for the community. So thank you.
Okay, Jessica?
Just a kudos to the chief and the city for taking the lead on this for everybody. It's a great partnership.
Yeah, great idea. There's a motion, if someone would like to make it on in your packet on page 103, and it says to move it to tonight's consent agenda, but we've already done that, so we would just be making a motion, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I do.
Got it.
Steve, can you just walk us through like the workflow? This approves, how does it work starting tomorrow, right? It gets set in place tomorrow. How does that work?
So we're going to be creating a sheet that has all the medications that are carried within the county. We're attempting to pare those down because there's a lot of them that are expensive that Dr. Benzinger hopes that we will give to patients, but in reality, we've not used them for years. So that's the second part of a process. Fire District A decides that they want to order these medications. They'll fill out a report that has kind of like an NCR type copy, and one shift will handle the collection and distribution of that medication. We're looking at QR and barcode readers, so there's nothing to do with writing. And this will create both an invoice with the administrative charge, as well as tracking of the medications that go out, all the stuff that we need to track that's logistically there. Once it's in their hands, they're in charge of disposal, but the stock that we keep and supply, if it needs to be disposed, then those that carry the medications will share the disposal equally. So if there's four agencies that have $1,000 worth of medication, we each eat $250. So like I said, on the front end, instead of everyone having to order their own, which has been ideal and has worked well, this will supplant all that. And then in the end, they'll also get a bill for that disposal. So we'll both track the outgoing as well as the disposal, and those costs are distributed through the system.
Thank you.
So I will move that council authorize the city manager to enter into an intergovernmental agreement, IGA, for cooperative purchasing of EMS medications and supplies.
You have a motion?
I second.
And who made that motion? Jessica? Oh, Gladys. Okay. Gladys has a second. More discussion? Okay. Mark?
Yes.
Jessica? Megan?
Yes.
Gladys?
Yes.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
And I vote aye. It's approved. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah. Sure. Great. Report from officers. Do we have any staff that has any reports this evening? I'm just going to look at, no one's turning their video on. So I'm assuming there isn't any staff that has any additional announcements. Dustin, planning director update, do you have anything?
Mayor, I provided that information earlier, but I have nothing more to add right now.
Okay, great, thank you. Jessica and Megan, visitor advisory committee, has there been any meetings?
So there was a meeting scheduled for last week. It got postponed to next Wednesday because everything's been changing so fast. And I think they were kind of waiting to hear about lifting restrictions. So I will report at the next council meeting.
Okay. Mayor Call. I think I kind of gave a report earlier when Tim was asking about kind of what's going on. So the emergency operations centers are still meeting a couple times a week. We haven't had any new COVID cases for a little while, which is really good. The Forest Service has had two meetings. I think we've had two meetings, and Mark attended one of those that I couldn't attend, and Rachel's been attending those to try and figure out how to try and open things pretty much all at the same time if possible. But they are doing a slow opening for those things, some day use areas first and then camping areas later, and you know, full waterfall corridor later. So they are doing kind of a phased approach with that, but trying to coordinate with Washington State Parks and Oregon State Parks in the gorge. So there's been, you know, quite a bit of discussion around trying to coordinate those things. I think that's all I have right now. Council call. So, Jessica?
I didn't have anything else to add tonight, Mayor. Thank you.
Megan?
Just real brief, but I had a phone call with Carrie Greer with Pacific Power, kind of following up on the email she'd sent about the public safety power shutoffs and kind of the changes that had occurred between our last meeting in December and this fire season. And nothing like super different from her email, but I did kind of pushing on the, you know, the shutoffs were really about internal to once the power's in the valley, they would have to shut off for safety reasons, but obviously transmission comes from the Dells or Cascade Locks. Those lines are owned by BPA, but Carrie had not heard anything from BPA about, you know, risk of preemptive shutoffs for transmission. That could change at any moment, but I think that's good news for this community. And then we just had talked quite a bit about really proactively informing local folks who use Pacific Power, and especially like, you know, downtown and waterfront businesses that I know have been planning to do a lot of active resiliency work, that they can maybe take a pause for a year given coronavirus and shoot that money to some other needs than to panic about also potentially losing power this summer. I haven't seen a ton of active education or outreach on that since our talk, but I'm hoping she is reaching out to those folks and following up.
Thank you, Megan. Mark?
I don't have much. I just want to really thank Rachel and her whole staff for both the work on COVID and the fact that, you know, we're getting real stuff done on tonight's meeting. You know, just up and down the whole list between the police station stuff and the routes to school. I'm just pleased that we're able to be a machine that's continuing to be efficient and respectful to the community while we're taking this COVID thing very seriously. So thanks.
Gladys?
Nothing new to add, just the usual spiel. Continue to practice social distance, stay away from folks or, you know, 6 feet, make sure you're washing your hands. And it's just recommended that you wear a mask. I know that it's a lot to wear, they're uncomfortable, they're hard to breathe, but it really can make a difference, especially when you're in the middle of a cramped store. So continue to do that, please.
Thanks. Tim?
Nothing here, but just echoing what Mark said. That was well said. I agree totally. Thank you.
Eric?
Thank you, Mayor. I guess a couple of event type things to mention. First, the ODOT ACT committee has basically been on hiatus since COVID set in, but we're going to have our first meeting a week from tonight on Zoom, June 1st. So I'll hopefully come away from that meeting with some sense of ODOT's kind of budget sense going forward, and I'm sure the news will be bad, but there'll be more information than I have right now, so I'll report back on that. Second event type thing is I was asked today by Emily Curtis, she's the president of Rotary, to participate in a very informal roundtable about COVID with this Thursday, actually, along with Susan Frost of Providence and former Port Commissioner John Davies. So if anyone is interested in that, but it'll just be a very informal discussion among Rotarians, but I'll be doing that. And if anyone is interested in that or wishes to participate, just let me know. And then by way of, I guess, substantive comment, I would just, I wanted to go back just very briefly, just by way of comment. I think it was our last meeting. Dustin had mentioned that he's leading kind of a thought process in terms of how can the city facilitate the use of its right-of-way rights, perhaps in a way to help various constituents, including the downtown business folks. I just wanted to share two things about that. I spent some time downtown this week and spoke with people, and I did feel a certain warmth to the idea of having some kind of special event on a Friday, Saturday evenings, kind of close the streets down and some openness. So that doesn't mean it's going to happen. I'm just saying that was the sentiment I received from at least some people. And it also, I had a thought that we may get this type of issue coming up in other arenas besides the right-of-ways, in particular parks. There may be that businesses or community groups wish to use the parks because it's an open space. You know, for example, yoga in the park is something that may have come up recently. It seems like something we should generally encourage. But without really trying to take a position on it, I just am raising it to maybe just so it's on. I'm sure it already is, frankly, on the mind of the city administration. But to the extent our parks are a kind of a public asset, which they are, I can see different elements trying to get into the park. So we just need to be thoughtful about that, having some structure around that, you know, facilitating open use space, but not in a way that is somehow unfair. And there's all kinds of considerations that I'm not trying to bring up as a point of substantive debate or discussion, but it just occurs to me that we may have people knocking on our parks to use them as a resource to facilitate, you know, athletic or, you know, like yoga in the park is the example I mentioned again. And we probably want to be thoughtful about that if it comes up further.
Thanks, Eric. With that, talking about the parks, I did some observation down at the waterfront this weekend, not Waterfront Park, but the port property. And, there's a closed sign on the event site, but there was a crowds leads to closures on Nichols Basin. So Nichols Basin had quite a few people in it. People were really trying to be social distancing. You could tell they were keeping in their little groups, but it was pretty crowded. And then people started spilling over basically into the event site, even though it was closed. They were also social distancing. They weren't supposed to be in there, but if they hadn't been in there and they'd all been over at the other area, they wouldn't have been social distancing. So I think, you know, that's the idea of opening up more open space for people to be in, if it's just going to be in a grassy area, because then it's not as crowded. So I guess just thoughts for, I'm not advocating playgrounds where there's equipment where little kids are going to have their hands all over it all the time, but, you know, the open green space and having all the parks open in the gorge so that people can disperse and won't be so crowded is maybe a good idea. A couple other meetings that I'm going to work to attend this week. One Gorge is going to meet. They're going to have a round table, and Rachel and I are both going to be attending that tomorrow. And then the Forest Service is having another meeting on Friday, and the Bi-State Bridge Committee is also meeting on Friday. So just some things that are happening.
Kate, what's the One Gorge meeting about?
I think it's just they're going to do a round table about the COVID issue. So, you know, I think they just want to kind of know what the city's doing. I don't think a specific agenda other than they want to talk about what all the different communities are doing about COVID. So.
I'll be there to share about the Mid-Columbia Economic Resiliency teamwork that I'm doing with my work hat on.
Oh, okay. All right. But around COVID. All right, I think that's all. Anything else that you have, Rachel, or?
No, thank you very much. And thank you for the kind comments. I'll certainly pass those along to the team.
All right. We are adjourned at 9:25. Robust discussions tonight. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Good evening. Bye.